What do you want? I don't want anything. You sent for me.
I did?
Yes. You telephoned. You said you wanted to see me urgently.
I didn't phone you.
It was your voice. He said he was number two. Someone in this village is impersonating him.
I have some calls to make. I shan't need you.
Right, sir.
You're a troublemaker, number six.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's just about, what is it, 25 minutes past five. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 25th of July 2025, streaming live just about from a corner of freedom close by Bristol city centre. So we've had a few technical problems today. We cannot connect up from the studio here up to the live stream due to internetradio.com or but or some reason, but we are live on TikTok, on Matt O'Brien's TikTok channel, and also on my Peter Berenius YouTube channel. We are live on YouTube. It's taken us sort of 20 minutes or so to actually get some live streams up, because obviously, and also to let you know, people who are on thisweek.org.uk, to know that there is actually a live stream going out, not just the nonsense that you're getting from last week or whatever it was on the talkradio.org.uk live stream. Anyway, don't believe a word we say as we share a few flashes of clarity from Bristol's Templar Port turned merchant venturer fortress in the Empire of Lies. We're live on DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, although perhaps because they can't get that live stream, we're not going to be there live. Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app again. The only way you'll do that is if you go onto the app and you have a look at the show page. I've updated that with links to the live stream, so you can actually go live to this program that some are listening to by just clicking on the link on the app. Available free, that app is from APK Pure or Apple App Store. But not from the evil Google Play. So, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its zero trust agenda, bending our minds with sophisticated distortions, and sometimes boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators often, and hatchet jobs on the heroes. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against the rentier class, World War III, and wage slavery. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the so-called solutions to the multiplying crises, housing, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, NHS, climate, the twisted Armageddonist accelerationist solutions crafted to make every crisis worse. The cabinet sold their souls so the politicians have nothing to say. Nick Land's Dark Enlightenment social Darwinists are cowardly Muppet underlings, want us as slaves to their AI or dead. So the British people are being really a targets, just as the Chinese and the Russians are of the British establishment. I think many people over the centuries have had quite good reason to point their finger at the British establishment. Now, very much the British people themselves can be doing that, probably for the first time, really, over the last few years since the Second World War, to such an extent that the establishment is supporting this genocide now in Gaza. So with the help, like the jabs of a doctor, the British people are prosecuting people for praying for unborn children, and they are also campaigning for assisted dying. So they want our right to kill ourselves. Anyway, whatever goes on, as we learn, you learn. Helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Reich, it's Matt O'Brien joining us again. No Martin Summers this week. He's got meetings, family business to sort out. Also joined live by Roland Dye and Sue Luger. So Iranian and Russian news censored in the UK by the telecoms cartel and by Ofcom, and us cancelled off Bristol Community FM. This programme used to be broadcast for 12 years every week on FM here in Bristol by Pat Hart, closed down by Pat Hart, the station manager, during COVID. And also we were cancelled from the People's Republic of Stoke Scroft as well by the trans lobby. But we're not cancelled here yet, quite. So we've got a couple of live streams and we'll put the show up later. I think probably best to introduce you first, Roland and Sue. Thanks for your patience while we're trying to get the technical problems sorted out here. Roland, do you just want to say something about the nuclear... I suppose it's Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, isn't it, really, here in Bristol?
It is, but I'm also speaking on behalf of XR Peace as well, so it's a combination of the XR...
This is to do with Extinction Rebellion?
It's CND. Let's stick to CND, right, because they've been doing it for a long time. So, coming up, it will be on the mainstream news that this year marks the 80th anniversary, 80 years since America and the Allies dropped two, not one, but two... They were called atomic bombs then, but we would call them nuclear bombs now, on Japan, on the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the media always goes for round numbers, so the 80th anniversary, it will be in the news, much talked about.
Right, so why is that so significant?
Well, what we're doing here in Bristol, Hiroshima Day lands on Wednesday the 6th of August, Nagasaki Day on Saturday the 9th of August. Bristol's been remembering this over about the last 5 years. So what we're planning is in Castle Park, there's a peace grove behind the ruined church next to the harbour wall overlooking Finsel's Reach. And at 8 o'clock, people will be gathering there for a silent vigil, followed at precisely 8:15 by a die-in. And that's to mark the exact time that that bomb was released from the plane and fell onto the city of Hiroshima, wiping out an unbelievable number of people in a vast firestorm. Following on from that Nagasaki Day, which falls on Saturday the 9th, slightly later time, which is interesting in itself, people will be gathering at 10:45, again for a silent vigil, and at 11:02 precisely, there will be a die-in to remember that moment when the second bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. Those two bombs combined killed up to a third of a million people, either immediately or due to their injuries, or later generations due to the horrible effects of radiation.
But hang on, because they did bring an end to the war in the Pacific, didn't they? A final end to the Second World War.
Well, that's what the propaganda machine leads us to believe. But since Japan was already collapsing under the weight of Allied bombing, it's strange that they suddenly wanted to test these two novel nuclear weapons. And it's because Russia was also coming into the war. And very obviously, that was a line in the sand to Russia to say, look, we've got these new ghastly, powerful weapons. Watch out.
Now, Sue, I always remember listening to the recording of President Truman announcing the dropping of the atomic bomb. He said it's being dropped on Nagasaki, a military base.
That's not true. That's not true. It actually killed, if I can just refer to some notes, up to a third of a million people, mostly civilians, were killed, plus many more injured or affected over successive generations by radiation. And this is going on again in Gaza today, if I can refer to that as well.
Yeah, of course. But, that's not nuclear bombs, is it?
Not yet.
Well, why do you say not yet?
Well, they are now bringing nuclear bombs into the UK. They possibly have arrived already. The UK is cooperating with America over flights over to Gaza. How long before things turn?
Well, surely in Britain, the possible confrontation is with Russia, not with Palestine.
Not necessarily, because also there are flights taking off, and I was recently at a peace camp in Lakenheath in Suffolk and near Mildenhall, and flights were taking off there to RAF Akrotiri in Cyprus, which were then going on to support the Israeli bombing of Gaza.
Okay, so what's going on up? Why were you over in Lakenheath?
It's a peace camp. It's a 2 year.
This is in East Anglia, isn't
that's
it?
That's in East Anglia.
Big American base.
There are two massive.
Well, you say huge. I say even huger. Two massive, massive bases, Mildon Hall and Lakenheath, right quite close to each other, aren't they?
Yep. We were there for 2 weeks at a peace camp with CND and Trident Ploughshares. While I was there, I did a site-specific installation on the fence regarding this. While we were camping very near Mildon Hall, the fueling planes were taking off at regular intervals all through the night. And the cognitive dissonance while I was actually installing this installation, which was specifically to do with the ongoing conflict in Gaza, the F-35 bombers were taking off overhead. It was chilling. It was absolutely chilling.
So where are these bombers heading? They're not dropping bombs anywhere, are they?
Yeah, they were heading for Palestine and Gaza.
So how do we know what the British government are up to? If you're telling me that bombers are heading off from Britain to bomb Gaza, are they?
They're heading over to RAF, to Akrotiri in Cyprus, to collect reconnaissance. They're doing reconnaissance flights over Gaza, which is then being fed back to the military in Israel.
Well, this week, Abby Martin from the Empire Report managed to pin down our former Labour leader, opposition leader, and nearly Prime Minister, because it was organisations of Zionists within his own party that actually sabotaged his attempt to become Prime Minister, largely, as well as the newspapers trying to portray him in 2017 and the run-up to that and the 2019 elections as a terrorist. So let's have a listen to what Jeremy Corbyn had to say about the American presence here in Britain, particularly the United States Air Force, as it began after World War II. Because, of course, the Americans had been here. They'd been doing daylight bombing of Nazi Germany. But apparently they left Britain at the end of World War II. But then, for some reason, a couple of years later, the American Air Force came back again.
US presence in Britain came briefly during the First World War, then again in the Second World War. At the end of the Second World War, the US troops all left. By 1946, they'd all gone, all of them. NATO was formed in 1948, and they came back 2 years later, and US bases were established in Britain. They then discovered it wasn't legal, so they put a law through Parliament in 1952 called the Visiting Forces Act. So the visiting forces are allowed to act under their own military law in the UK. And the myth of British independent nuclear weapons was completely broken when the Polaris system was bought from the US. That was during Kennedy and Macmillan's time. And essentially, the whole nuclear weapon systems are American run. Now, I'm going to Japan next month as a speaker at the 80th commemoration of the use of nuclear weapons in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Well, it was appalling, and everyone knows how bad it was. Everybody knows how many people were killed immediately. What the weapons that were used in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were just fireworks compared to what is in one nuclear warhead that we have now. We're in an incredibly dangerous situation. And so I've spent my life opposing nuclear weapons and asking countries that signed, and all of them did, including the USA, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, stand by it, which means no proliferation of nuclear weapons or technology, and that the five declared nuclear weapons states, Britain, France, China, Russia, United States, should all take steps towards disarmament. None of them have done that. Briefly in the 90s, there was a reduction in warheads, which was good. Now, they're all rearming. So, a nuclear war would, even a limited nuclear war, if such thing is possible, would create a nuclear winter, global famine, and global destruction. Just one weapon being fired off would set off a chain of events that is truly terrifying. I said as leader of the opposition, when pressed very heavily on the media about this, they said, what kind of man are you if you're not prepared to use nuclear weapons? I said, because I'm just somebody that likes people to live. Simple. Just want people to live, and I'm not going to start a nuclear war or use a nuclear weapon against a civilian population. And I think we just need to change the language and start thinking about peace. I'll just finish on this. What's security? What's real security? Because if you ask some people, they say, well, security, that means we've got to have guns, we've got to have knives, we've got to have tanks, we've got to have rockets, planes, bombs, everything. Okay. For most people around the world, real security would be knowing they've still got a home, their kids have got a school, there's a hospital, a doctor, and there's clean water. That's security. That's security. I want to bring up my children knowing that that's what security is really about.
Well, it's funny. One of the things he says there, clean water. Well, we know we don't have clean water, not in our beaches or in our rivers at all anymore. Why can't the government prioritise? Matt, have you got an answer for us? Why can't the government prioritise clean water over bringing these new nuclear weapons here into Britain, which obviously are going to make the whole of East Anglia a target for nuclear weapons?
Well, then they won't be able to proportion the public money for all the nice weapons that they want to uphold, you know, their idea of security. And I totally agree with what Jezza is saying there. You know, sort of people in power that tend to want to hold on to it and are a bit paranoid, they tend to think that security means dominating and threatening, so no one can challenge you, no one can... But it's a flawed fallacy because, as he says, you know, real security is everyone's needs being met. So if you're not invading and bombing countries in the Middle East to take their oil, they don't have a need to send terrorists over to fly planes into your towers. You know, why did they fly? You know, Osama suggested people ask, why did we target New York and not Amsterdam or Auckland, New Zealand? You know, there is a reason.
So you think Osama was behind the 9/11 attacks?
Oh, obviously that's debatable, and who had knowledge of it and who didn't share that knowledge is another question.
So you mentioned an installation. I find this difficult. So can you just explain what you do and what you did at Lake and Heath? This is isn't it some sort of like artwork?
Yeah, basically I use art as a form of expression and education for people, and for the last 2 years I've been choreographing and using my artistic voice to educate and inform people. The site-specific installation was a row of very tiny baby vests tied with red ribbon to simulate blood, with messages written on them. There's sort of rows and rows of the messages are arms for hugging, not for war, babies, not bombs. If we don't end war, war will end us. Give me a chance. What if this was your child? And another one with crosshairs on it saying, I am not a target. Underneath that, there were bags of rucksacks with limbs coming out and ribbons simulating blood. And just to get the message across that school bags are for books, not for the body parts of children, which is what they've been used for in Gaza. And underneath that, there were bloody shrouds of size of very small babies. And another thing said, what if this was your child? Just to pose a question to people to get them to think about the reality of war.
I can remember this now. This is a long time. This is probably 10 years ago, the Royal British Legion putting on their website, we are working to end all war. We believe the end of war is possible. Then some new people took over the Royal British Legion and they dropped all that. So, you know, I stopped donating to them. I started buying the white poppies instead of the red ones. But the idea, of course, that many people are trying to promulgate is that there can be no end to war. This is part of human nature. And as elites start to lose control, so for example, as they are in the United States with people, the big social divisions opening up both in Europe and the United States, then war is their way out of this. And that's an inevitable cycle in a way that you can't break.
I dispute that. I think you can break it. I think we can We need a resolution to be able to live in peace. You know, all war is doing is perpetuating the arms industry. It's making rich people even richer. It's completely futile. And, you know, people that use the argument saying, well, we need it for our self-defence. The UK are the aggressors. We've not been invaded. We are the aggressors. I'll just leave that hanging there.
Well, no, nobody seems to be about to invade us. We keep being told, don't we, that Putin is sitting there wringing his hands wanting. Certainly the Palestinians aren't trying to invade us, or neither are the Iranians, although we're told sometimes we've got to watch out for the Iranians hiding behind various street corners and this sort of thing. Anyway, Roland, this whole idea of just getting back to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, do you think it's, I mean, that's the last time the nuclear weapons were ever used in anger. Do you think it's possible to stop their use again in the future?
Certainly, and that's why we need to turn things round from the appalling and highly expensive arms race. Anybody just likes to look up what American arms spending is this year. It's measured in the trillions, and that's money which should be spent on other things, more socially useful things. Can I just do a summary of what Britain has been spending our money on for the last few decades? You mentioned Polaris. Now, currently we have Trident, which is a submarine-based nuclear weapon system. It's loaded with nuclear missiles and warheads. If all of them are fired, as they're designed to be, that would kill, theoretically, something like 45 million people. So if we're shocked at the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which does look like something like Gaza, and similar unloading of munitions on that crowded part of the planet, just think what 45 million deaths would look like. And although they haven't been used, Britain uses this as a big stick to threaten the rest of the world. So in various conflicts, from Iraq to the Falkland Islands War, they let it be known that, you know, the coordinates of whatever are dialed into the system. Now, in addition, Trident's now coming up for replacement because it's aging. It's getting very unreliable. Try not to worry about that, folks. So it's coming on with the Trident replacement.
Actually, you say that, but they did a test and the Trident nuclear warhead went off. Actually, it was no warhead on it. It was just a missile headed off over towards America instead and landed in the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, they've only actually done two test firings.
It was, wasn't it? It went off. It went the wrong way.
Yeah, they had to blow it up in midair. There's only been two live tests and they've both gone wrong. The other one did a corkscrew and landed back in the ocean. So that's our money being spent. And now Trident's wearing out, so they have to replace it with a new submarine system, which will cost £200 billion over its lifetime. Now, add to that the Americans bringing their nuclear armed planes back to Lake and Heath. It's fairly well established now by research that that's actually happening right now. Plus, Keir Starmer, just after they cut the welfare budget, then announced they were going to buy a new fleet of F-35 bombers to be based at RAF Marsham, also in East Anglia. So you can see the way the balance is going. Cut social welfare, the things which keep people alive in our cities, and spend it on more and more warfare. This is utter madness.
Well, there's lots to talk about. Lots going on, isn't there? So it's not just about 80 years ago. It's about what's happening today. On the CND's website, they've released an article. It says, Starmer come clean. The British public deserve the truth over deployment of US nuclear weapons. CND calls on the British government to make a formal statement on the return of US nuclear weapons to Britain and allow for a transparent debate and vote in Parliament on any such development. It follows reports from the media that high-priority US transport aircraft designated for nuclear cargoes detected landing at Lake and Heath last week. This appears to have been a one-way drop-off of B-61-12 nuclear bombs. This means the US nuclear weapons are on British soil for the first time since 2008. Despite the government's secrecy, evidence has been emerging. The base has been primed for a new US nuclear weapon mission, including doubling of nuclear-capable F-35 squadrons and upgrades to the base's special weapons storage bunkers to hold these B-61-12s and the building of a surety dormitory, which is accommodation for the extra personnel needed for such nuclear weapons. So what's happening here? I'm just going to ask all of you this, because it's such a big question, really. Maybe Matt, for first you. What they're doing is they're bringing these bombs in, but they don't want anyone to know about it. And they expect that maybe... Actually, it's the British public that they don't want to know. They don't care whether the Russians know.
Mm. Yeah, and this is this arrogant idea that certain people have, that they know better than us, they can't trust us.
Well, it's not democratic, is it? It's not really democratic.
It's not.
This
really
is a decision that should be made by MPs, but apparently it's just being made by a few people who don't think that anyone else in the country is should be privy to the information.
Yeah, and things like this affect all of us profoundly. I mean, it makes me extremely uncomfortable just to see those weapons coming in, because the saber rattling they're doing with superpower, the nuclear superpowers like Russia. I mean, when Starmer approved enriched uranium tipped missiles to Ukraine, which Russia and Putin had explicitly said,
This is depleted uranium, isn't
depleted
it?
Depleted uranium, you're right, sorry. Putin and Russia officials said explicitly, do not give these weapons to Ukraine. If you do, we will consider that a crossing of a line and we may respond accordingly. I was looking to, you know, get a bus ride out of here, you know. So it's just like... It's an anxious time. It doesn't make me particularly want to stick around.
Well, what about England? New Zealand? I mean, you're a Kiwi after all. New Zealand has this quite sensible, it seems to me, amongst all of the Five Eyes countries, if you want, America, Canada, Great Britain, Australia, New Zealand, of being anti-nuclear. They won't even let American... I mean, this is the difference of attitude here in Britain, isn't it? The Americans are bringing in these nuclear weapons, but they don't want anyone to know about it. Now, in New Zealand, the attitude, correct me if I'm wrong, is that unless the Americans tell them whether or not there are nuclear weapons on a ship, that ship can't dock.
That's right. And because US ships have a policy of not telling, there are no US ships allowed in Auckland, in New Zealand. We've got a total ban on nuclear weapons and warships, nuclear powered ships. That happened in the, early 80s. We had David Longy as Prime Minister. And it was actually a wonderful thing I want to draw attention to, because it's relevant also today to Gaza, because, you know, people wonder, what can we do? I think one of the most powerful actions at the moment is the flotilla idea of sending civilian ships with aid to Gaza from various nations. And there's various organizations teeing this up at the minute, 1,000 ships to Gaza. There's a new one announced, the Global Sumud Flotilla. And there's a meeting at 2 o'clock on Sunday here in Bristol at the Malcolm X Centre to discuss that. So get along if you're in Bristol. I think these are really powerful initiative, and what it did in New Zealand, very similar action. There's great photos of it. You can see there was a civilian flotilla, all sorts of ramshackle vessels from, you know, kayaks to fishing boats to speedboats, went out into Auckland Harbour to greet these US warships and a submarine. Really evocative images, you know, just totally peaceful civilians going out there bravely. And what that did, you know, people go, oh, what does it do? You know, if you get stopped and you don't get to deliver it, that it's a symbol. It's really like a galvanizing symbol. And what that did in New Zealand, it just put so much pressure on it that the government came on side, and David Longy, the Prime Minister, put it to the US very bluntly, you know, and with some very good speeches, actually, saying, you know, step closer to the mic, I could smell the uranium on your breath, to the US ambassador. And yeah, so New Zealand stood up to it, and it's held since then to this day.
It's funny, isn't it? The last time I think we in Britain we had a prime minister that really stood up to the Americans was Harold Wilson, who refused to get involved in Vietnam. That was 1970s, maybe a little before your time, Matt. But the rest of us can remember it. But I think you're right about the flotilla. If you don't mind, we'll just drop the nuclear thing for a minute, because we need to have a look at what's going on with this flotilla. Gaza bound, and it's called Handala flotilla. It may not, there may be more, but anyway, the Middle East Eye did an interview with one of the people who's involved in that. So let's have a listen to that this week.
A grassroots group called the Freedom Flotilla has brought civilians from around the world together in a bid to break the blockade by sea. Their latest mission is now underway, a ship called the Handala, named after an iconic Palestinian cartoon character. The Freedom Flotilla set sail from Italy last week with 21 passengers and aid provisions on board. Jewish American activist Jacob Berger.
We have to step up at the end of the day. The politicians need to fear the people once again, because they need to realize they'll lose their office and stuff like that if they continue to support a genocide. That's why we need a very famous quote from an American poet is, the revolution will not be televised. And what that means is we need a revolution of the mind first before anything else. So we, at the very least, we need to start getting Americans to start to care about what's happening in Gaza. I have way too many friends and people who go about their daily life every day like nothing is happening, like it's not our American tax dollars funding the genocide and the Holocaust that is happening in Palestine. So we need to really reach the people first. And when we reach the people, then hopefully the politicians will fall in line.
Because if you're talking about governments and powers who are arguably culpable for what's happening in Gaza, there is the State of Israel, the military of Israel, and that is a body that you are likely to come face to face with on this journey. Have you thought about how you will express your message to them when that happens?
Well, yes, we are a peace-loving group. We train in nonviolence resistance if we are intercepted illegally. Because may I remind you that nothing we are doing here is illegal. We're sailing under a flag. We're going from international waters to Palestinian waters. So really, they are criminals if they try to intercept us. They try to downplay with Greta the kidnapping, and that was a kidnapping. So we have no fear. We're going to make sure that we get our message across. We're going to be unified. We already agreed that we are going to be doing a hunger strike if we are intercepted. We will not allow their Hasbro BS to get out there. You know, they all kind of harped on the sandwich thing. Like, Greta, we gave her a sandwich. Like, no, we've all, in unison, all 21 of us have agreed to a food and water strike in that situation. And we do not plan on, giving any information to Israel. And we, hopefully our governments will contact them to make sure that we are released back to our home countries.
And it is due to reach Palestinian water over the weekend.
So that is the Gaza-bound Handala flotilla aid ship, as reported by Middle East Eye. There are a few people who are reporting this stuff. Not much of this is reported by the British press. Usually they seem to wait until there's some sort of disaster, like the Israeli helicopters come down, people get shot, etc. by them. Matt, what's the point, do you think? I mean, surely this is only a little bit of flour they're bringing in by these aid ships. I mean, it's not really going to be enough to feed 2 million people.
No, and they're not under any illusions that it is. What it is a symbolic attempt to draw attention to what the blockade, which is illegal and starving people to death. News coverage, if you get, you got 20 or 30 different countries sending civilian boats, it's a news story. So the news will actually cover it. The news will actually talk about the fact that there is this illegal blockade. The question is, why are they stopping it? It's like the Martin Luther King civil disobedience actions, where they know it's a crime to go into these segregated diners, but they go in and they sit there and they're trained to sort of take the abuse and not react. So there's nothing violent about it. But what it shows is the violence that they receive when they do that, when they step out of line, so to speak. And it highlights, like, you kind of give the opportunity for the tyrant to behave tyrannically under the watch of the world and highlight them. So,
It reminds me a little bit of the Nazis. I'm not saying obviously the flotilla, but the Nazis didn't like they didn't like the Slavs, they didn't like the Gypsies, they didn't like the Jews. They hated them. They liked killing them. But as soon as people like the Brits turned up, okay, so they didn't really particularly want to have a war with Britain, but Britain declared war on Germany. And so this is a way, I think, isn't it? But sending in a flotilla is saying, actually, we look rather like you. We're not Arabs. Yeah, but we've had enough of you guys, and we think you should try treating all human beings equally.
Yeah, that's right. And a symbolic thing, you know, it can have, like it did in Auckland, it was like a, in New Zealand, it was like a, it galvanized the public opinion, which made the media focus on it, and then the politicians have to follow, you know, when there's that groundswell of public opinion. Yeah, and it's just so clear what's right and what isn't. So it's just about highlighting that. I think that flotilla idea, there is the one ship at the minute that's on its way, and Godspeed to them. But there's also initiatives to get multiple vessels at once. And I've done a little research where it seems that perhaps the Israeli offensive, the IOF, could potentially stop and board.
IOF is Israel Occupation Force.
Right. Yeah. And so, yeah, as opposed to defense, which we know it isn't.
Offense force.
offensive force.
Sometimes it could be.
Exactly. So, you know, they could only perhaps stop and board about 20 vessels at once. So if we manage to have more than 20 vessels, one or two or more will get through. So these are being organized now. So check in your local areas, look out for a captain. We actually went down to the Bristol Harbour Festival. There's this big after the PAL action, we went straight down there just to sort of relax, and it turned out we decided, oh, let's go look for a captain to take us to Gaza. So I made a little sign. Actually got talking to a Royal Navy guy who was looking after a ship aptly named Exploit. I thought my friend was joking. Oh, this ship's named Exploit. And I was like, yeah, that's about right. It actually was HMS Exploit. But the guy was actually really lovely. I was actually saying, hey, we're looking for a ship to Gaza. Would you be interested? And he said, I don't know if I could say, but he clearly, I was asking, do you think it's weird that we're not sending any ships to aid Gaza? And he said, you know, he quietly was agreeing. Yeah, it was clear. Actually, really, he didn't want to explicitly say it, but he was clearly wondering why.
Isn't this partly the problem, that people are more interested in keeping their jobs than they are in saving lives?
The banality of evil, that's right. It's there's only a small number of tyrannical people, and then it's a whole lot of people that are, like, subservient, obsequently going along with it.
I feel awful saying it, but people like him are cowards. They shouldn't be in that job. If they're supposed to be in the forces, aren't they supposed to be... have some courage.
Yeah.
But this guy's a coward because he's afraid to say it.
Yeah. Oh,
I know it's wrong, but I can't say anything.
Yeah. I mean, of course, you can relate to someone's need for their job and all. And we were talking to the police at the PAL action thing about that too. And we were just saying, look, there are other jobs. If your conscience, if you really are about the law and, you know, and keeping the peace and justice, and your job is now asking you to go against all of that, and you can see it, and they could, because you could see them.
Well, the thing is, though, it's like a bit like journalism in the police. It's actually quite good to have people who are outwardly, you know, doing their job, but inwardly losing bits of paper. So it's called pro-noia. This is the first time I heard about this. It's called pro-noia. That is that the system is actually out there to help you, not out there to get you. And so that the people who are doing these things to you don't believe in it. And so a bit of paper gets lost, you don't go to court, you don't get charged, blah, blah, these things suddenly go away. And I think there is an element to which, you know, it's a bit like Soviet Russia. People realise that the system is in a mess, and so they just make mitigating circumstances. But one thing's for sure, the British Royal Air Force are very much in, you know, these are the guys that won the Battle of Britain, and now they've turned into the Nazis. They're out helping, you know, they put swastikas on their planes, and they're now out helping the genocide in Gaza. I know, Sue, you touched on this earlier. This is one of the most worrying aspects of this, is that we've now got our armed forces going out there doing reconnaissance, transport, alongside the genocidalists.
It is, and it's absolutely terrifying. And I agree with what Matt was saying about the police. You could see it in their eyes. You could see they were ashamed of what they were being asked to do.
Very much, yeah.
They were reluctant. They held their heads down. They wouldn't make eye contact. And we asked them, you know, what do you feel about this? And they said, we're just doing our job. We're not allowed to have opinions. Mm. And I just don't know what's going on. It's just frightening. It's awful. It's terrifying. I worry.
Well, I think the problem is at the top, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is the problem, and it's the Starmers. It's the tampon. I call him Tampon Charlie.
Yeah.
You know, the City of London. These top of the establishment, and slowly but surely, the country is rotting from the top down. Mm. It seems to me, and people are just trying to cope. Whether it's a protester stood there in the street, an old lady of 70 years old who's a peace campaigner, or whether it's a policeman being told he's got to arrest her. People are just trying to survive this crazy and dysfunctional leadership. Talking of which, the Air Force is run by an Air Chief Marshal, and Declassified UK's editor actually managed to find him this week and stick a microphone under his nose and say, what are you doing helping the genocide?
Air Chief Marshal, lovely to meet you. My name's Phil Miller. Sorry, I'm a journalist. How's the conference?
It's great, thank you.
Why are you still sharing intelligence with the Israeli military?
Sorry.
You've been, please don't touch me. I pose no threat. I'm a journalist. I'm allowed to ask questions of the head of the Royal Air Force about... Please don't push me out of the way. I'm a journalist. I have a right to answer questions. Why are you still sharing intelligence with Benjamin Netanyahu while he's wanted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes in Gaza? Why won't you give us a proper sit-down interview about this? We've asked your office for an interview. Why don't you want to answer questions from the media about your intelligence sharing with Israel while it's committing genocide in Gaza?
Thank you.
Would you like to comment?
No.
So that was the head of the Royal Air Force, Air Chief Marshal Sir Rich Knighton, who's about to become the head of the entire military in September. He's the man responsible for sending Royal Air Force surveillance flights over Gaza almost every day for the last year and a half. Now, they've said that these flights are looking for hostages, but hardly any hostages have been found, and one of the few times hostages were rescued, hundreds of Palestinians were killed in that operation. If he was confident that his intelligence sharing wasn't making the UK complicit in war crimes in Gaza, you would think that he would speak to the press. We've already asked for a proper sit-down interview with the Minister of Defence to talk to senior officials like him, Admiral Radakin, and the Defence Secretary, John Healey. Each time, we're refused. And that's why we have to come to events like this, where the top brass from around the world are assembling, and yet the issue of Britain's complicity of war crimes in Gaza never seems to be addressed.
Who are you? I'm from the Royal Air Force, and you were just trying to chat to the Chief, so I just wanted to know who you were with.
So we're from Declassified UK.
Oh, cool.
We put in several requests for interviews with senior officials, including Sir Rich Knighton.
Today. Sorry about that.
Okay, but the trouble is there never seems to be an interview about this issue.
Well, look, you can
surveillance flights over Gaza. Issue. We do, but we just get one line each time. It's a matter of huge public importance.
I can't help you with this today, I'm afraid.
That's fine.
I just wanted to check who'd be trying to do this.
Yeah,
thank
of
you.
Course. All right.
As the Air Chief Marshal was whisked away, news broke that his Israeli counterpart had landed in the UK. Major General Toma Bar had just arrived at a Royal Air Force base in Oxfordshire, according to an Israeli TV channel. Was Knighton rushing there to greet the man responsible for Israel's blitz of Gaza?
Well, he's too busy for an interview because he's rushing off to see the Israeli head of the Israeli Air Force, it sounds like. Now, the problem for this chappie, Sir, of course, Richard Knighton, Sue, is that he could actually be arrested himself for complicity with genocide and war crimes. Maybe that's why he doesn't fancy being interviewed.
Exactly, and actually they're all complicit and they should be tried. It's just scandalous, the secrecy, the things that are happening, the dishonesty, we're not being told the truth.
So
they will come to account one day. They will be held to account.
Interestingly, Phil Miller from Declassified UK actually did get a bit of an interview with his handler, his public relations person, who was almost answering a few questions. But they have a wall of secrecy up. These are the people, of course, who are responsible for the arrangements with the Americans, Roland, for bringing these nuclear weapons in too. It sounds to me like they believe they're above the law. So whether or not they want to be interviewed about the war crimes in Gaza, they're not interested in having questions from members of the public, the press, or MPs.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I'm sure your listeners out there are spotting this increasing drift to authoritarianism in this country. But with that goes the rise of ordinary people standing up and making a difference. So Martin Luther King, I'm going to mention Gandhi, non-violent tactics are being used. So the ridiculous prescription of the direct action group Palestine Action just recently has led to a wave of people across the country all standing in solidarity, literally standing with signs saying, I'm against genocide, I support Palestine Action, and the police having to go in and arrest them, as happened in Bristol and other provincial cities and in London. And I think the next call out is for 500 people. It's suddenly a job for respectable older people. Two Quaker friends of ours who are well into their 80s, the police just couldn't bring themselves to arrest them last Saturday on College Green and just melted away. So suddenly age and infirmity is mightier than the force of the constabulary. But these are classic non-violent tactics. And the state always walks a very difficult line. I'm always talking about dilemma actions. This was mentioned in Extinction Rebellion. You go out, you do a protest, you block a road. If they let you get away with it, you've won. If they repress you, people who may not have agreed with why you were doing it suddenly are shocked that you're being repressed. And that's what we see with the Defend Our Juries movement that's happening at the moment. Remember when General Dyer marched his troops into the main square at Amritsar back in the 1920s and gunned down thousands of people. That was in India.
Oh, yeah.
In order to suppress the Indian movement for independence from British colonial rule, it actually had the opposite effect. Rather than scaring people off, it actually increased the movement and eventually led to the British being booted out of India. So the ruling class always walk that very difficult fine line. Do we repress, do we react, or do we let it run its course and perhaps it will fade away? At the moment, we see them repressing and people stepping up. So this is happening. Find out about it, folks, and join in if you can.
So, Matt, this action at the weekend, the police actually, you know, you were describing these sorts of things going on, but the police actually decided, did they? Oh, and we can't bear arresting these two old ladies.
Yeah, it was an old couple, a lady and a man, and I actually just posted a video of that today on my Instagram and Twitter, I believe. And it was this just joyous moment of celebration when they withdrew. I'd just been giving the police a bit of 1-2 about all their different ways they are not just complicit but active participants in the genocide, meeting with the Israeli generals and the such that are suspected of war crimes. We can see it live streamed. Surveillance flights, as we've mentioned, daily over Gaza. And then special forces have been also been admitted to being sent there, but there's a denotice to British media not to report that.
Well, they seem to go everywhere, actually. Whenever there's a conflict and we are supporting some country but we're not involved, that's where our special forces go, because they're not scrutinised by Parliament. They're outside the scrutiny. They're directly scrutinised only by the Intelligence and Security Committee, which don't scrutinise, and the Cabinet Office. So they're outside the purview of MPs, journalists, the public. They can stick those special forces wherever they want, really, and they pretend that they're not there.
And it was, pretending they're not there. It's certainly very interesting that Matt Kennard of Declassified, or formerly Declassified UK, published the D notice that he got.
Oh, right.
That he found.
Good.
And he wasn't sent to him. But it showed that even though the... it had been officially acknowledged that these special forces were being sent there, but it just hadn't been reported on. And, you know, that D notice would have been shared to all the major news outlets. So it just kind of shows you how that operates. And those D notices apparently are not a legal notice. They don't have to be followed. But there's just been, there's that banality of evil again. It's not only these corrupt people at the top that we should focus on, but it's actually like all the people of conscience that are in these roles that are going ahead and doing it. That's how evil is perpetuated. It's by people that should know better going along with it, which is why I'm just doing my job and I informed the police, Bristol South, the Somerset, Avon and Somerset Police, that was not a defence at the last major hearing on a genocide, and people that used it were hung. And I got a bit of a nervous laugh from them, but I think the point came across.
Well, they, you know, who was also hanged after the Second World War was the editors of the Nazi newspapers.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They were. And yeah. this is for basically spreading false hate information, the sort of thing that we might now deem Islamophobia, the Tommy Robinson types spreading stuff like this, hatred of Muslims, and trying to blame them for the acts of the NATO, CIA, MI6 sponsored armed fake Islamic gangs like ISIS. But anyway, look, that's a whole nother tale, a whole nother story. I think maybe, you know, we should have a look, just to sort of to try and round up. Could you just remind us again, Roland, where and when events are happening around Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Because I think most of us, and in fact, in the 1950s, it was a massive movement, wasn't it? Personal friends of mine, family friends, etc., were on these Aldermaster marches.
Yep, so just to recap, Hiroshima Day is Wednesday the 6th of August, so here in Bristol people are meeting in Castle Park behind the ruined church at 8 o'clock for a die-in at 8.15.
8 a.m.
Meet at 8 a.m. for a die-in at 8.15, the exact moment that the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. And then if you're free on Saturday the 9th of August, that's Nagasaki Day, we will be gathering at 10:45 on College Green for a die-in at precisely 11:02, the moment that the bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. And there will be a rally and poets and speeches and a choir and a solemn event, but also a chance to remember and pledge to stop this happening again.
And Sue, maybe you could just remind us about what's been going on up at Lake Neath, because things are starting to hot up. I don't think this is going to be the end of the protests by CND, is it?
No, I don't think so. And they do have a monthly vigil up there. They've also been targeting RAF Marsham and, again, RAF Mildenhall. And that's ongoing. I can't remember exactly. I think it's something like the first or second Saturday of every month.
So if you're having a fortnight in the Norfolk Broads, you can pop over to the protest.
You can, yeah.
As we used to do, when I was in college up in Yorkshire, we used to go to the protests up at Menwith Hill, just because we happened to be up there. We may as well just join in. And because the American nuclear British presence was extremely, I mean, I think it's important to remind everybody, in the 1980s, this was all massive when they brought the cruise missiles into Britain. And there were quiet, secret, like we have now, agreements to bring the cruise missiles. Once people found out they were having these giant, gigantic trucks, lorries going around the country with nukes on the end of them. And of course, you don't really want one of those in your housing estate next to your school, or in fact, anywhere near a population centre. Maybe you could stick them on Rockall or somewhere right out of the way. So, because they're targets. What they do is they bring... And by the way, folks, the Russian intelligence is much better than it's ever been. You're not going to get... I think I'm going to stick my neck out here. I don't think you're going to get to fire any of these at the Russians or even launch an aircraft with a nuclear bomb on. They're going to take you out before you even get off the ground. So what is the point? Is there a point? What is the point?
There is no point.
There is no point.
Profits for the armed companies. Yeah.
Yes, maybe.
And let's remember that the last time the Americans had their nuclear armed bombers at Lakenheath, there was one or two accidents which could have reduced East Anglia to a sterile desert. So we are doubly, you know, at risk from this. And it's got to stop. It's got to stop. And together we have to do it and build a better world for everybody.
Let's certainly hope so. It seems to me that there isn't any real objective in this other than it's an empire dying. Some sort of empire is kind of conking out here, and it's their last thing they've got left is they've got these big bombs, and we can scare everybody with our cowardly air vice marshal in charge of it all. Oh dear. Anyway, it's like a bit of a dystopic thing, but anyway, I'd like to just round off our discussion about the nukes with the latest from Todd Ryder at the Todd Ryder Institute. I think it's actually called ryderinstitute.org, because he's been uncovering masses of evidence over in the United States, ex-Massachusetts Institute of Technology guy, loads of documentation from archives, and he makes the point right at the very start that none of what he says is actually classified. So please don't come after me, he says to the American military.
I'd like to give an overview of the wartime German atomic bomb program. This is an updated version with a number of new archival documents, including some that were actually declassified as recently as 2024.
Great. All right.
And this information comes from archives all around the world, U.S., European, even Australian archives. I've found some of this information, but many other people have also helped in finding this information. So I do strongly encourage anyone else who's interested to go digging and see what they can find. And I should also point out that everything here comes from entirely unclassified or declassified documents. Now, I know that I'm going to blow through all these documents, all this evidence at about warp 8, but people shouldn't be dismayed by that. So I encourage everyone to go to my website. The website address is here, and you can download all these slides and a whole lot more. There are extra deleted scenes. There's a special making of featurette you can see. So please download all that, and I'm going to blow through this. So the wartime German program, if you read most history books, the program was quite small and very primitive and never really got terribly far compared to the Manhattan Project. But it's been quite difficult for historians to really reconstruct the wartime German nuclear program for many factors. It was not just in one location, not even just in Germany proper, but it was spread all over German-controlled Europe. And on this map is a reminder of just how large the area was that Germany controlled during much of the war. So the program was scattered over that area, including even in several countries that were nominally neutral, but were helping Germany, including Sweden, Switzerland, Portugal, and Spain. The program was also divided among many different government agencies. So the German Army, German Navy, Air Force, the SS, even the German Post Office, and many other groups. It was divided among many different companies, the chemical company IG Farben, the major electrical companies AEG and Siemens, various uranium-related companies, Degussa, Auer, Treibacher, and so forth. It was spread over many different research organizations, the Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes and universities all over the place. And it was also done in many underground facilities that were resistant to Allied bombing. So having the program set up like that made the German nuclear program much more resistant to Allied bombing and Allied intelligence, but it has unfortunately made it more resistant to modern historians trying to reconstruct all of this. There are other difficulties for historians. Toward the end of the war, the German forces destroyed or buried an awful lot of their work, an awful lot of their documents. And then what was found by many different organizations from many different countries and then taken back to goodness knows where in all those different countries. And a lot of it is still classified here, even 80 years later. And then finally, simply, a lot of people are not terribly happy to rediscover all this. It tarnishes the modern public images of many of the countries involved, both Axis and Allied countries, as well as even neutral countries. So people don't really want to hear this terribly much, but I think it is very important history. Here is a recently rediscovered document. This is from a very top German nuclear scientist who came to the United States during the war, and this document ended up in Leslie Groves' files for the Manhattan Project. And according to this very highly placed scientist, no later than January 1938, the very top levels of the German military were actively recruiting scientists, even Jewish scientists, to develop nuclear weapons for Germany. As shown by this and a number of other documents, the German military was in charge of the nuclear weapons program from sometime in the 1930s until about 1942. And then in 1942, control of the program seems to have passed to the SS, Heinrich Himmler and those guys. And for example, here is a post-war Allied interrogation report. They were interrogating one of Heinrich Himmler's top adjutants, top assistants. And according to his assistant, Heinrich Himmler in the SS had a panel of scientific advisors. And so he lists the panel of scientific advisors. There were 11 people. Of these 11 people, six of them were actually nuclear experts, and the other five were earth science experts with expertise quite relevant if you plan to go testing and deploying nuclear weapons. So it gives you some idea of what was on Himmler's mind.
Well, that's Hidden History, his latest appearance by Todd Ryder. He did a series of three, 2023 and 24, which went through, first of all, the nuclear weapons materials acquisition and development and processing, then another one which was the actual bomb designs, the specific including hydrogen bomb designs the Nazis had in the Second World War, and then a whole another section on the delivery system. So they had the nuclear triad, I think they called it, or trinity or something, where they the nuclear weapons are delivered either dropped by bombers from the air, or launched from submarines, or ballistic missiles. And they even had a manned ballistic missile that they had actually tested by sending it into space, but they actually built a mock-up before the end of the war. So this was, of course, a massively powerful bargaining chip at the end of the Second World War. And I think most of us know about the Operation Paperclip and the movement of people like Wernher von Braun over to the United States, which is where they cooked up this whole nuclear program. I mean, I wonder, Sue, do you think it's going to be possible to eliminate nuclear weapons, especially in a world that seems to be getting ever more tense?
That's what I hope and pray for every day. In a perfect world, yes.
Well, it's good to see you positive. What about you, Roland? Yeah.
Yes, it's a time for all good people to stand up and make a stand in some way or another. And small groups have been doing this for slogging away for a long, long time. And now it's time to get on board, do your bit one way or another. There is more of us than them, as the old slogan goes. Thank you.
Well, that's right. It's okay in a democracy, isn't it? You can vote them out. But unfortunately, these people don't seem to take much notice of that. What do you reckon, Matt?
I tend to think that we're in a new age of transparency. I mean, we have global surveillance. Why not use it to make sure that, okay, so if the argument is we need bombs in case someone else is building them somewhere, that might have held prior to this massive global surveillance network we have now. I just tend to believe, like, look, the real weapon we need is just constant light shining in every nook and cranny, but we also need to publicly control who's looking at that and make sure that we are actually stopping people from doing terrible things, not protesting. But we should be able to monitor people building weapons and so that eliminate the threat that way. Donald Trump gets a lot of bad press, and sometimes he deserves it. But he did actually get very little press for calling on Russia and China to meet together to talk about denuclearization. So there is even potentially movement if we could only focus for a minute and capture, you got to take. We tend to sort of black and white everyone, sort of say this person is this person is that. I think it's a real missed opportunity that more people didn't get around behind what Trump was saying there. He seemed quite serious. He was calling for meetings. If we had a public push around that, how amazing would that be? We might actually be further along in this.
Something funny is going on with Trump, though, isn't it? He seems to be being sort of pushed all the time away from all those things he said he was going to do, ending the war in Ukraine, reopening nuclear talks with Russia. He seems to be being pushed away from all that. Or is he just losing? Is he himself losing heart, do you think?
I don't know what else he could have done. I'd like to hear anyone's views on that. But I've seen him do everything he could on Ukraine, from stopping the weapons to lambasting Zelensky in front of the media in the White House, to pulling him aside in Rome during the Pope's funeral, telling Macron to off, and sitting him down one-on-one. I got to hand it to him on that. Like, he's tried, as far as I can see, he's done all he can practically and diplomatically to stop the Ukraine war, which is one reason I thought he's a lesser evil candidate compared to the Democrats who wanted to continue that.
And briefly, if anybody wants to know, the law is actually on their side. Way back in 2017, so that's 7 years ago, the UN passed the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. And this has now been ratified by 130 countries around the world. Not the nuclear-armed ones, of course, but the non-nuclear-armed countries are not very keen on the thugs and the bullies on the global stage, including our country, from having these awful weapons. So international law is on the side of us protesters. I just thought a nice thought to finish
on. Are the nuclear weapons, surely they're never going to be used? They're just there to threaten people, Roland.
Well, For example, the British nuclear weapons are actually made in the factory just off the M4, 1 mile south of the M4 near Reading, but transported up to Scotland on public highways on armed convoys every 4 to 6 weeks. Occasionally they have technical problems on the road. Accidents do happen. It's exposing us all to risk. The worst case scenario, if one of those caught fire, it would impair Britain's ability to function as a sovereign state. We're talking disaster for us here at home, and we're paying for it as well. It's total madness. It's got to stop.
How much is it costing? I mean, you talked earlier about this new ballistic missile programme too, didn't you?
Well, the Trident replacement alone will cost £200 billion. That's 0.2 of a trillion pounds over its lifetime. And we're paying for that out of our pockets. That's money it could be spent on the health service or giving fuel allowance to old people in cold flats
forth. How about that's funding help for disabled people for the next 100 years?
That's a very good use, yeah. And then we've got the American nukes coming back to Lake and Heath. Then we've got Starmer buying British nuclear bombers to be also stationed in East Anglia. And by the way, they're not really our bombers. It'll be a PFI scheme, so we're paying double for it. It's all total madness, and it's about time we stopped it all.
Well, I'd like to see more of the London press. I mean, we've got thousands of journalists in London, billions of pounds every year poured into these big media corporations. And I'd like to see more of them inquiring a little bit more into this rather than leaving it to the chap from Declassified UK to go and doorstep. A bit more of that, please, from Channel 4 News and
might
the BBC.
Might have something to do with those millions of pounds going in there, and where are they coming from, Tony?
And also maybe quite a lot of these media empires keep their money offshore. And they don't want anyone to be talking too much about how they're avoiding paying so much of their tax. We don't. In fact, we're volunteers. We run on slivers of tin, as they said in Ireland here. Anyway, look, thanks ever so much for joining us, Roland Dye and Sue Luger. I'll put links up to the local CND and national CND on the website, and also some information about where these events are happening for Hiroshima Day. It's not just happening in Bristol. It's happening elsewhere, I imagine, too, Roland.
All around the country and all around the world.
Fantastic. Well done. So just to go to your point about Trump, there is this guy, Jeffrey Epstein, which might be related to Donald Trump's not start quite going with all the things he said he was going to go with. And someone I've got an immense, in fact, as an old sort of old school journalist myself, somebody like Richard Sanders on Double Down News, and he's done stuff for Al Jazeera a lot in the past. He did, I think, an excellent look at the links between Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein this week.
6 years ago, I made a film with Kathy Newman for Channel 4 called The Prince and the Paedophile, about Jeffrey Epstein and Prince Andrew. In the wake of that film, I had a series of very lengthy telephone conversations with Virginia Giuffre, who was Jeffrey Epstein's best-known victim. Virginia told me all the men she was farmed out to, and that in itself is a lengthy and horrifying list of men. And it would not surprise me at all if President Trump was striving to protect those people.
I don't understand why the Jeffrey Epstein case would be of interest to anybody. It's pretty boring stuff.
These people who gathered around Epstein were not outlandish freaks. They weren't outcasts. They were a very representative sample of the American business, political and academic world, the American elite. So it's hardly surprising that both parties, when they're out of power, are demanding openness and transparency around this case. Once they're in power, seem to be a lot less interested in all the names coming out.
He's dead. He's gone. It's all been a big hoax. It's perpetrated by the Democrats, and some stupid Republicans and foolish Republicans fall into the net.
Jeffrey Epstein was very probably connected to the intelligence services, to American intelligence services, and to Israeli intelligence. He quite possibly had compromising material, tapes, recordings of powerful men. All of this will have contributed to why he got away with his actions for so long. But also you have to see Epstein as an albeit extreme example of the power and the privilege and the impunity of the tiny elite of fabulously rich people who effectively run the world today.
Are you still talking about Jeffrey Epstein? This guy's been talked about for years.
Now, Virginia was certainly aware of Donald Trump as a sleazy presence around Jeffrey Epstein and moved in exactly the same world. In fact, there was clearly a period where they were quite close friends, although she was clear that she was never abused by him. Although Virginia was recruited by Jeffrey Epstein while working at Donald Trump's Florida home, Mar-a-Lago. In a magazine profile in 2002, Donald Trump described Jeffrey Epstein as a terrific guy, likes women almost as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side. Trump and Epstein seem subsequently to have had a falling out, but they were absolutely part of that world together. Epstein died in a prison cell. Today, Donald Trump is president of America. After coming to power, Trump got the Justice Department to release the Epstein papers. I don't think there was a single document that hasn't been sitting on my computer for 6 years. It was a completely bogus exercise. And actually, what was significant was the documents released by Trump's Justice Department were heavily redacted, whereas the versions we had were unredacted. I have the flight logs and I have the little black book. So Alexander Acosta, who was Trump's Secretary for Labor in the first administration, back at the time Epstein was arrested in 2007, 2008, he was the U.S. Attorney for Southern Florida. In his hearings to take the job of Secretary for Labor for Trump, he reportedly said that he had been told Epstein belongs to intelligence. Leave him alone. It seems to me absolutely clear Epstein had connections to the intelligence services, probably to Mossad, probably to the American intelligence services. Of course, Ghislaine Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell, is well known as having had extensive links to the intelligence services. Robert Maxwell was buried on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem. His funeral was attended by six former heads of Israeli intelligence, and he was eulogized by the serving Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, who said he has done more for Israel than can today be told. Robert Maxwell very definitely moved in that world. Whether Jeffrey Epstein had connections to the intelligence services in the same way that Robert Maxwell did, I should think it's quite likely. So I woke up on the morning of April 26th to the terrible news of the suicide in Australia of Virginia Giuffre, who's the best known of Jeffrey Epstein's victims. The thing about Virginia was the abuse she suffered at the hands of Jeffrey Epstein was not the first abuse she had suffered. She'd been abused throughout her childhood. One of the repellent things about people like Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein is they home in on, they have an instinct for the vulnerable, for people who, in Virginia's own words, have been primed for abuse. She was angry, obviously, with Jeffrey Epstein. She was angry with the phalanx of women that surrounded Jeffrey Epstein and were his enablers and facilitators. Particularly, she was angry with Ghislaine Maxwell. Mary fucking Poppins, she used to call her. She would say, I'd never have gone to that man's house if it hadn't been for that woman with her posh English accent. And of course, also, during those long conversations, we talked about the men she had been farmed out to. She was abused by Jeffrey Epstein. She was abused by Ghislaine Maxwell, who she was quite clear was an abuser, a very sadistic abuser, as well as being a facilitator. Virginia told me she was then abused by a whole string of men who Jeffrey Epstein presented her to them, sort of on a plate as a sort of gift. Prominent men from the worlds of business and politics in the United States, obviously Prince Andrew, world leaders. And what was extraordinary was you discovered that when very powerful men who can pretty much have whatever they like in life are offered a 16-year-old girl on a plate, bizarrely, what they seem to want to do is to hurt her. The number of them who were sadomasochistic was extraordinary. One of them very nearly killed Virginia. Virginia was a very strong woman, apart from this one man who she was terrified of. She used to say, I'd go for him if I didn't have children, because I have children. I won't do that. I remember talking to Virginia about her watching the Prince Andrew interview. She was furious. She was so angry watching that interview. And what angered her was his arrogance, his belief that he would get away with it.
I can tell you, categorically, I don't remember meeting her. Nobody can prove whether or not that photograph has been doctored. I didn't sweat at the time because I had suffered what I would describe as an overdose of adrenaline in the Falklands War when I was shot at.
And I remember she said, that 1%, they believe they are above the law, that 1%. Now, you listen to other Epstein victims talking at length in interviews. And they say exactly the same thing. The thing that absolutely enraged them and repelled them was the elitism of Epstein and all of the people who surrounded them. The belief they were above the law, the belief they existed in this gilded club of wealth, power, influence and connections. It was a gilded club they belonged to, and very firmly, you did not. And anyone who did not belong to that club was worthless. We had Jeffrey Epstein's infamous little black book. It was enormous, hundreds and hundreds of names. The first thing to understand about the little black book, and this isn't commonly understood, is it was really Ghislaine Maxwell's book. And you can tell this because the numbers, for the most part, have American prefixes, but they don't when it's a British number. So for the most part, it's her book. Virginia used to point out Jeffrey was actually a rather weird, strange, nerdy person. What Ghislaine did was she was his sort of social lubricant. She opened up social worlds to him. This was Ghislaine's entry point to his world. It was her selling point. And she was keen to show off. The people who matter in the Little Black Book are people who also appear in the notorious flight logs and also in the Little Black Book who have numerous numbers. There are over 20 telephone numbers connected to Bill Clinton. Donald Trump, 14 numbers. Alan Dershowitz, 11 numbers. There are 7 numbers for Ehud Barak, the former Prime Minister of Israel. Also, 10 numbers for Peter Mandelson, who is now the British ambassador to the United States, of course.
So that's good old Richard Sanders. I mean, he is just one of the best in the global, in the world. Very, very steady, very solid information, very clearly presented. He goes for the facts, which are the most devastating facts. What about that, what he was saying? I didn't know this. Maybe you knew these things, Matt, but it is that the numbers were all, for Ghislaine's phone, they were, basically it was Ghislaine's book, wasn't Jeffrey's book. Seems to me she was the main instigator of that. She was the finder. She was the one that went out to find the girls, for example.
That's interesting, eh? We do seem to enjoy making men out to be the monsters, and sometimes they are, you know, maybe more often than not. But it's like, we need to be a bit more balanced. There are some female monsters out there. I think women have shown in many ways they can do anything a man can do. And unfortunately, that also includes being some of the best warmongers going today. You know, we've got von der Leyen and Hillary Clinton and Victoria Nuland. You know, a lot of people remark they're just as capable, vicious warmongers as anyone else that has come along. So that's been one of the disappointments of my life so far, is thinking and hoping that the feminist movement would bring about a more peacefully minded leadership group. And that hasn't eventuated. The early returns are not good, I would say. So perhaps we need to look for other ways. But Green and Woman, coming back to point before, shows that, my gosh, when we do come together, and this was a group of mostly women who initiated a huge human chain around this base in Greenham Common, where the nukes were being held for the US, and they surrounded it. I think I got up to 30,000 to do a human chain around it, which is incredible. And they had a long-term camp there, many people will know. But I found this story really inspiring. A friend of mine from New Zealand, Briar March, made a documentary about them, which is very good. Highly suggest, checking that out. The Mothers of the Revolution, you can see that on various streaming platforms. And I took that sort of peaceful, non-violent solidarity action as an inspiration for my suggestion to do the human chain around Julian Assange's prison, which ended up bringing me to the UK and was the biggest action done to free Julian in the end, although we moved it to the Parliament. And so now Green and Women are mobilising this to stop the current new deployment of nukes here. And yeah, it is madness. Mutually assured destruction, isn't it? That's not a solution. Something that's going to guarantee to kill everybody. It's not a good solution, is it?
Well, I'm reminded of the Times article. It must be 18 months, 2 years ago, maybe 2 years, not quite, just after the coronation, Camilla Wears the Trousers. And it was talking a lot about how Charles likes to be sort of steered by Camilla, that she, a lot of her contacts, her friends in London, will tell her things, give her bits of advice that she passes on to Charles. So much of what Charles is doing, I don't know, I've just literally tried to find that article. It's disappeared. The article itself is not on the Times website anymore, but that most definitely wasn't. In fact, if you, probably best way to find it is go back through our old shows. You should find it back on one of those. But it was particularly insightful, I thought, the idea that, of course, that the king is in charge. Well, actually, maybe the person who was his mistress for a couple of decades is really the person running the show. So, you know, if it's a weak man, it's fair. If it's a strong man, I mean, he's probably going to do what he wants. But if he's a weak man, if he's a coward, then maybe the lady's telling him what to do. Also this week, with the sad death of Ozzy Osbourne. I mean, this is amazing. Mm. You were talking about it might have been his last gig. He must have known he was had some sort of terminal illness, Matt.
Yeah, I tried with all my might to get there, and he, it was clear from the interviews he was giving, the statements before he performed, that he felt like he was on his last legs. I mean, he was literally sat in a... I'm using the present past tense that England seems to use, sat instead of sitting. He was sat in a throne made for him that was like a, yeah, because he was getting about in a wheelchair. He's been sort of more or less in and out of being bedbound and on painkillers the last, I think, 4 years. He had a bunch of complications and then surgeries go wrong that messed up his spine. And so there's been criticism of him.
So interventions that were supposed to help him didn't.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
this is happening quite a lot, isn't it, these days? With, oh, I suppose it always has done with surgery.
Mm. Yeah, it's tragic. You'd think that someone with his financial backing could get good help, but there you go. It happens to it can happen to anyone. But yeah, it's very sad. And he, but it's really admirable to me that he pulled together this concert. He was clearly pushing himself just to be able to sit up and do this, but he, it was a wonderful event. Unfortunately, I met the sort of, I really came confronted there with the obsequience and the,
they wouldn't let you in, would they? Yeah, you told us about this.
Fever,
yeah.
To stick into rules and the worst hallucination of what the rules could be. Enforcing that with glee is what, that's the kind of impression I've got. Well,
is it Schadenfreude, it's really called, isn't it? The idea, yeah, that you're taking pleasure in seeing other, someone else taking suffering. Pleasure.
Yeah,
and there's a traumatic thing there. The little Hitlers.
Yeah, and someone on YouTube, I right after this happened, I was like, I'm going to look for something about the UK, and I saw this video that said, why I left the UK. I clicked on that. He described the exact experience. The first video I clicked on, he said, why I left the UK, and he spoke about this obsequience, and he spoke about how, yeah, it is enacted with glee, you know, this enforcement of rules, because it's like a trauma. It's like they've encountered this brutality towards rules and non-lenience, non-using a bit of intelligence and a bit of heart, and they're people enjoy inflicting it because it's cathartic, you know, it's in response to themselves and being
maybe they're goats
on the other end,
maybe they're goats, not sheep. I mean, this is the way I do see the world, like sheep and goats, really. People who are public-spirited and people who are pretending to be public-spirited. No, you don't.
Well, I don't know. No, it's, I'm getting my head around that sheep and goats analogy there. So certainly it's like victims becoming bullies. Yeah. It's like that's a pipeline. And all of us need to confront that. Whenever our needs are threatened, it comes up. And we tend to want to latch on to punishing and, you know, the person that we feel is victimizing us. But all of that is really coming from a philosophical narrative space, and you know, it doesn't give you a right to enact harm. Sure, you want to call for justice and you want to protect yourself, but that's different to enacting harm. That's where violence and non-violence separates, and there is a difference. But Yeah, anyway, so, sequence Banality of Evil. It's,
well,
it's,
yeah, but I mean, I think we're going to play in the break, we're going to play one of Ozzy Osbourne and Black Sabbath's songs, which does certainly, you know, it's talking about God. It's called After Forever, which is a great title, I thought, you know, because everyone sort of thinks, oh, well, my lifetime is forever. And this is the modern way of thinking, isn't it? Oh, well, you know, it's all Darwinistic, social Darwinistic, or just Darwinistic, and there is no life after death. This is what, you know, most people are kind of taught basically nowadays. So they're not even taught much of I think they should be. In fact, Anne Lemon from the National Union of Teachers, National Education Union now, was said on this show in the past, she thinks that all children should be taught a bit of evolution and a bit of creation and let them make their own minds up. But with Ozzy Osbourne, what do you make of him? You were saying last time, you were a couple of weeks ago, you were saying that, and now he's passed away in between times, that he wasn't satanic. A lot of the imagery was, wasn't it? But then, of course, you get people with Christian Zionists with Christian imagery, which is they're not Christians.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they spoke, Black Sabbath have spoken about the fact that they were under a different name. They're actually called Earth, which is a much more hippie name. And Ozzy was influenced by the Beatles. That was his idol, was Paul McCartney. So, but they used to practice across the road from the cinema that happened to, and they couldn't believe, they noticed how people were coming and paying to go see these horror movies. So one was, I think it might have been a Boris Karloff film or something. There was a film called Black Sabbath. And so they borrowed it literally from this horror film. And but they were, you can actually tell that they were God-fearing men. You know, as you say, the hype around them and heavy metal was that it's satanic and evil. But,
well, I think there was some that what definitely was, you know, with loads of very powerful imagery and the stuff I wouldn't even bother listening to.
Oh, other bands.
I'd switch it off. Or Black Sabbath. Not other Sabbath, other bands.
Oh, yeah.
And some of the Sabbath stuff was much more like, almost like they're celebrating it rather than criticizing it or just using it. I mean, at the end of the day,
what's an example of
what
that,
they
though?
Did is they jumped onto a sort of, this is really going to sell records. And it did.
Yeah. But I push back. I can't think of a single lyric or graphic that has celebrated violence or the devil in Black Sabbath.
What about the
music?
Song Black Sabbath on their original album? This is all loads and loads of demonic imagery, that sort of thing.
Well, yeah, about a figure in black, you know, at the end of the bed. This was a dream that the bassist had. But if you listen to it, it's not glorifying anything like evil or hatred. It's actually talking about the fear.
It's also turning
evil.
It into money, isn't it?
Well, the church talks about the fear of the devil and they get money. The Black Sabbath are doing the same thing. They're talking, they're not celebrating the devil. They're talking about how scary it is.
His wife, a Zionist.
So what you're saying about that,
so his wife obviously has an influence over this and his thinking, etc. But
yeah,
what we were just talking about with Camilla and the idea that there are men out there who are actually influenced by people behind the scenes, by women behind the scenes, by their partners, etc. So you don't really see their partner, but the partner is actually having quite a big influence.
Yeah, I think that people have been skewering Ozzy. A few people have taken the moment to, just on the day of his passing, you know, people want to take advantage of the news cycle and skewer somebody. They have pointed to, and it is tragic, that Ozzy's name has appeared on a couple of letters recently, preposterously, saying that the BBC has an Israel bias. Incredibly naive, that is. And so that's tragic, but I want to give a lot more of a reasonable.
You mean a pro-Israel
benefit
bias?
Of a doubt?
You mean a pro-Israel bias?
And no, the claim.
Anti-Israel
the claim
bias.
Was this on this
and
letter.
Ozzy is part of it somehow.
He put his name on that. He signed his name on this ridiculous letter. So that's tragic, but I just want to be much more reasonably minded about this and say that, well, the guy's been on bedridden and on painkillers for a few years. His wife, Sharon, who I used to really admire because they seem like an amazing couple living their dream together. She's done the business side and he's done the creative side. And I thought it seemed like an ideal.
So she's his manager, basically.
She's been his manager
for
a long
time. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because Jimi Hendrix's manager was working for MI6.
Yeah, he seemed like a very shady character indeed. But yeah, I mean, Sharon, she seemed great to me until she came out and criticized Kneecap and called for them to be banned from Glastonbury. And as now
she couldn't resist
signing these letters. And she convinced Ozzy not to do a song with Kanye West, who wanted to do a version of, might have been War Pigs. It would have been awesome. And, you know, Kanye's outspoken and controversial, but so was Ozzy Osbourne. You know, it's a real shame. So I think she's probably, to your point, I do think she's the one that's probably pushing this. And Ozzy is in a vulnerable state. You know, he's not going to be of sober mind.
Yeah.
He is vulnerable and, on painkillers.
If she's like full on Zionist, I just hope she didn't poison him.
Yeah, I think she seems to be pretty staunch Zionist, and so.
And if he wasn't, maybe, you know. Anyway, let's not go there right now. No, but anyway, sad to see he's gone.
We're there. That's what's happened.
And we're going to hear a bit of this song. We're going to hear a hymn first of all, and then we're going to hear Black Sabbath's "After Forever," which is quite an interesting little take on it. Is there a God or not? And the final song is something which will hopefully blow your mind a bit, which is just out, and it's about Jeffrey Epstein, called "The Blackmail Files." I could not find the name of the artist of it, but it's a pretty full-on explanation with a few explicit lyrics. But before we have the break, Patrizia's ode this week, "The Fog of War." US of A shall always find the leading man in wars behind death and bombs and killing fields, embargo oil and killing sprees. True, man, the name, such name should bring, weak puppet for warmongering. Pearl Harbor, hate, debate, still strong, the good, the bad, the right's the wrong. Preemptive strike, decision made, embargo oil, expansions laid. Pacific Fleet, the target plan, US of A, no way, Japan. Atomic bombs to test, let's go. Hiroshima, the first will know. A lesson teach to Japan, nuke show with Fat Man, atomic bomb, snow. Bragging, wagging, dog the tail, civilians burnt beyond the pale. Purple hearts, so many minted, still going strong. War never stinted. Life vaporized like smoke in Baki, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. A testing ground, vile plans were made. U.S. hegemony was laid.
talking about Jeffrey Epstein?
The strategy so far?
I call it the Epstein hoax.
I was just scrolling. Same old faces on my feed. But the story started to connect. Trump, Epstein, Mossad, blackmail. I thought I knew how the world worked. But the truth was darker than that. And when I looked closer, I couldn't unsee it. I used to think corruption, war, ties, C-SPAN speeches in the televised lie. But Epstein's jet had a guest list long, and silence bought with the promise of wrong. They got photos, footage, files on lock. Politicians sweating every time they talk. Trump grin said he barely knew the man, but the island tells a different plan. Cameras hidden in the chandelier, powerball through the whisper of fear. Mossad trained him, that's the word. A honey trap with a $1 billion slur. Now I see why they parrot that phrase. Israel has the right to defend every goddamn day. It's control ever with whisper deals, truth exchange for donor meals.
They say the pen, but it's all disguise. When kids get bombed.
The light, but I ain't hating, I'm just naming the systems that keep on maiming. This ain't about Jews or Muslims, prayers. It's billionaires with blackmail stares, from Congress halls to BBC. They all keep quiet or they cease to be. They got takes, they got threats, they got dirt. One wrong move and your family's hurt. How else you explain the one voice line? Like war crimes got a PR spine. I see the patterns, follow the thread, and every road leads back to the dead. Justice has a deadline. Or is it just inconvenient for those who profit from the silence? Yeah. I used to flinch when they said that word, till I saw how it's twisted, how truth gets blurred. Call me what you want, I know I ain't hateful, just awake, and that's what makes me dangerous. I saw the files, I saw the names, I saw the victims, I felt the shame. This ain't theory, this is fact, and no spin room gonna take it back. From London to D.C., the blackmail's deep, and the cost of truth is losing sleep. See who's pulling strings, and I'm done pretending. This is slam dunk massive. We see you. We ain't silent. We speak the names.
Okay, just like Richard Sanders naming the names there. Wish I could tell you who it is. I'll certainly put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Actual name of the song is Blackmail Files 2025. And so that's just out this last week, actually, looking at Epstein, naming the names. Matt, do you want to just say something about whether you think that Trump was compromised by Epstein, and that's one of the reasons why he's saying that he can't trust anybody anymore, and maybe his policies are just falling like flies?
Yeah, it definitely seems credible that he's in the files, judging by the way he's acting. And apparently, you know, there's reports that he's got 1,000 FBI agents trying to find mentions of himself. There's photos of him. I think most people have seen this. I think all this stuff just seems to have a lot more weight given how things are being run. I would slightly question, like, what he hasn't delivered on, because people are upset that he hasn't released the Epstein files, but he never promised to. But at the same time, I understand why his base thought he might have, because all his... The people around, it was quite clever, really. All the people around him.
He said he would. He said he would. But he said he was more. I think he did. In the clip we played a couple of weeks ago, he said, I would be a bit more reluctant, he said. Yeah. Something along those lines. But he said he would, but he would be more reluctant.
He didn't.
He said yes. He said yes, and then he sort of backtracked a bit.
He didn't say yes.
He did say yes.
He just said, I'm not sure.
He said yes. No, he said yes, and then he said, oh, I'm not so sure. But so he did say, so he said both, right? So politicians are allowed to do that if they're a bit devious.
I didn't hear him say yes. I heard him say, I'm not sure about that.
Well, you didn't hear it. I did. So he most definitely did say yes, which we played a couple of weeks ago. He's asked about 9/11. He's asked about the JFK files, and he's asked about Epstein, and he says yes to all three, but then he rolls back a little bit on Epstein. Well, maybe. Anyway, so the point is, fine. Mm-hmm. We'll have a listen to it. Fine.
Even if he said yes, and then he said, I'm not so sure, you'd be a fool to take the yes, because he said, I'm not sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But he did say yes. Anyway, look, the point is he being blackmailed? Are many of our leaders being blackmailed? Is that why they're leaders?
Yeah, I think it's certainly...
I don't think you need to blackmail Starmer. He just does what you want anyway.
I mean, John Kiriakou did a good piece on this recently, and saying, you know, if you are Mossad, if you want access to these people, you can't just go out and, you know, get in touch with Bill Clinton, but, you know, you get Ghislaine Maxwell and, you know, young woman, and then you sort of trick them. You know, I don't actually think they're pedophiles. I think that people get a little bit caught up in the whole, oh, they're all the political elite class, or they're all actual pedophiles, and they're looking for... I don't think that's the case. I think it's more likely that actually they were just enjoying being entertained by young women they didn't know were underage, you know, and it's like 16,
you
know, 17.
You remind me very much of the photograph, famous photograph of Prince Andrew with Epstein, where he goes back to speak to him, and as they're walking in Central Park, someone's spying and taking photographs of the pair of them. Now, Andrew looks to me as if he's saying to Epstein, how old was that girl?
Wow, really? How do you...
You just look like at... He's got that look, which is like, you conned me, haven't you?
Wow, really?
Look.
Yeah,
I but anyway, so...
That's how I imagine it goes
that's
down.
That's how it possibly, you know, that would make sense, wouldn't it? Anyway, the long and short of it is we've got a genocide going on week after week on this program. We're trying to pull it apart, trying to stop it happening. We're doing a little what we can to explain who's doing it, why they should be in prison, etc. So this week, slowly but surely, the British establishment is being pushed and pushed towards condemning it, not helping it. So now there's more words. At the beginning, we had Starmer supporting the genocide, particularly saying it's okay to starve people, this kind of thing, to stop water supply, which obviously is complicity with genocide. Now we've got this week the Foreign Secretary David Lammy giving a statement. I'll put the full version of this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, condemning the Israeli action. But is he going to actually do anything? So we have some quite good parliamentarians here holding Lammy's feet to the fire this week.
What immediate actions are they taking to stop this litany of horrors? And what will they do to hold those responsible to account?
I'm frankly astonished at the statement of the Foreign Secretary. At a time when we've got daily lynchings and expulsions on the West Bank, dozens being murdered as they beg for aid, I'm just beyond words, really, at his inaction and, frankly, complicity by inaction at what is going on. He himself said there's a massive prison camp being constructed in the south of Gaza. He knows that leading genocide scholars from across the world now are ringing the alarm bells, and yet he has the temerity to show up to this house and wave his checkbook as if it's going to solve his conscience. Can he not see that his inaction and, frankly, cowardice is making this country irrelevant? Can he also not see the personal risk to him, given our international obligations, that he may end up at The Hague because of his inaction? And finally, really, frankly, an appeal to the Labour backbenchers. We can't get your leadership to change their minds. Only you can, if you organise and insist on change.
I understand the fury that the Right Honourable Gentleman feels. But I have to tell him, that it demeans his argument when he personalises it in the way that he does, and it is not, it's unbecoming and not something that the House expects, particularly of most more senior members.
Earlier today, then, 31 countries put out a powerful message: the war must end now. There must be aid going into Gaza, unrestricted. The hostages must be released, and all parties must uphold international law. It was sent to Israel, and by return, this powerful message was rejected. It was denounced by Israel as disconnected from reality.
Shocking.
So what now? So what now? In that statement, the 31 nations said, we are prepared to take further action to support an immediate ceasefire and political pathways to security and peace for Israel, Palestine and the entire region. So what are we going to do, may I ask? And does that include the final recognition of Palestine?
Well, the Right Honourable Lady is right to call into question so quickly the Israeli government rejecting the advice of its friends and 31 countries coming together horrified by those who are losing their life simply reaching out to get aid and humanitarian care.
Last week in Bogota, the Hague Group of Nations met, led by South Africa. Those nations pledged to support the ICC, to support the ICJ, to refuse all arms sales to Israel, to refuse the facilitation of arms to Israel, to refuse anything that enhances the occupation of Gaza and the West Bank. In short, global opinion supporting the Palestinian people. Will the British government also sign the Hague Declaration and support those group of nations determined to bring the world's attention to this, to end the genocide that's going on and the occupation that continues?
Well, I will speak to my South African counterpart about that issue. But can I say to him, we here in the UK support the ICC, and indeed it receives funding from British taxpayers and the ICJ. We also stand against what we are seeing in the West Bank and what we are seeing in Gaza. So much of what he has said, I would also say, is consistent with UK policy.
So that's just a little clip from there. There was lots of discussion about this. There were quite a few MPs actually in the Houses of Parliament this week quizzing on Foreign Office questions the Foreign Secretary David Lammy, Matt. So, I mean, he's saying that he really... What annoys me more than anything else about this is Lammy starts his statement talking about what are the Israelis doing, complaining that they're not doing enough. The question, of course, is what is he doing? What is the Foreign Office doing? And why aren't they doing enough?
Yeah. Yeah, they've been towing this line since the beginning, since October the 8th. And the same with the US politicians. All the Western politicians have the script. It's like, talk about how mortified they are about what's going on, while they do nothing about it. In fact, they don't do nothing. They supply F-35 fighter parts to drop the bombs. They provide the reconnaissance data, daily spy flights. They allow refueling Israel ships to planes to land at our bases. They provide the political cover, and they send out D-notices so that the media doesn't report about some of these ways that we are not complicit, active participants. in this genocide. And I thank the member for bringing up the fact that David Lammy will be should be facing the Hague. If that doesn't happen, there is no. And he also very well said that he's actually what he's risking is the UK becoming irrelevant. That's what they don't realise. You can get away with, you know, being a bastard for so long before your reputation is gone, and that's what they're doing. They're souring the reputation of the West. Anything we could pretend to stand for, the whole world can now see. The emperor's new clothes, social media, the internet has exposed all of this. They have to learn that they have to adjust. They either have to actually stop being such or become much more tyrannical, and that's they're choosing to go much more tyrannical and fascist at the moment. So we have the PAL action clamped down, and I just want to draw attention to the fact that there is a massive call out for people to take part in civil disobedience against the prescription of Palestine Action, to lift the ban, and actually, if you do support them, to speak your mind and join 500 others. It's a cutoff point. If they don't get 500, they're not going to go ahead, but it's basically like a challenge. So sign up at wedonotcomply.org if you'd like to take part. And
so do you have to
action.
Get arrested?
No, but there is the risk of that. And so there is, you can read the
but you haven't been arrested,
guidance.
Have you? Why haven't you? Hang on, why haven't you?
Yeah,
been
why
arrested?
Haven't I? They haven't gone after anyone, it seems, yet who's spoken online, which is what I've done. I've clearly said that I support Palestine Action still numerous times. Gordon Dimmock, a journalist, UK journalist, has also surrendered to the police and wrote them a letter ahead of time, said, oh, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to come into the station. They didn't arrest him. So different police jurisdictions have taken it a different way.
Yeah, they have, haven't they?
Nobody yet has been charged. There's an ongoing appeal process happening. So really what we're doing, this movement is doing, is to get them unprescribed.
Well,
I think
the important thing to say is that there are all sorts of other roles that you can take in these demonstrations, supporting people who are being arrested, legal support for all sorts, talking to the cops. There's loads and loads of things that people can do.
That's
and
right.
You don't have to. If you want to get arrested, then you can try. And if you're in Bristol and you're elderly, the police might just walk away.
Yeah, and there are risks to taking part, you know, and it would be irresponsible not to inform people about those. I was willing to face, I thought it would be unlikely to actually do jail time for this because I think we're going to win, but the risk of doing, you know, 3 years might really be there, even though no one's been charged yet, and they've been only arrested under the lesser penalty of a maximum of 6 months. But I was prepared to face all of that, except I have had to pause and consider the ramifications of travel, which is quite serious, you know. So potentially, I'm trying to get more advice on this, but it's possible that you might have a black mark on your name for traveling to countries like the United States, and maybe even some of their allies. So I just worry. So I'm trying to get more information about that. But I think that that's certainly concerning to me, and could be a huge imposition. But at some point, I think you just got to decide: do you want to travel to countries that are going to uphold this genocidal regime?
If you travel to Iran, you'll know you're then not allowed to go to the United States or Israel.
Mm.
So, would you go to Iran because you then couldn't go on to America?
I don't have immediate plans to want to go to Iran. I mean, I'd love to be able to enjoy going to the United States, watching an NBA basketball game for the first time. I've always been a fan of that. Or touring as a musician. But at this point, you know, I'm starting to look at countries that aren't committing genocide as places that I'd like to be. Ireland, China, Russia, South America.
Iran?
Yeah, well, let's see how they go. There's plenty going on.
They're not doing genocide. What do you mean?
They're not doing genocide. They're doing other things that I'm not in favor of. But they're also not bowing down to the US, and I applaud them for that.
They're a bunch of revolutionaries. Anyway, thanks ever so much for joining us, Matt. Thanks for plugging everything. I'll also mention again the 80th anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the nuclear weapon attacks being looked at here around, well, here in Bristol and around the country, Wednesday the 6th of August, 8 a.m. in Castle Park, and also a similar venue nearby. That's Saturday the 9th of August at 10 a.m. For the Nagasaki anniversary.
And one more is tomorrow I'll be joining some other great speakers in College Hill to speak about these attacks on our democracy. Yeah, that's at midday College Hill here in Bristol.
Well, we'll also be talking about that in a minute with Simon Killane, former councillor from Wiltshire, who's done a lot of... He got absolutely destroyed and character assassinated after he tried to do the right thing as a councillor, and he's got a lot to say about the dying empire, what's wrong with democracy in this country. Anyway, thanks, Matt. But we're going to hear now a clip about this film. A film is called To Kill... A War Machine. It's been done by Palestine Action and released just beforehand. And here are some of the filmmakers talking about the problems they've had actually getting it out there.
We were at a screening at the Old Spotted Dog in Clapton, and it was just before the screening started we got the news. And so since then we've had a time to think about it. We've been told, advised just to carry on with the screenings as usual because nothing has happened right now. But what we did do was we moved the digital release of the film forward by a few months. Initially, the digital release was going to be in September. We were going to have a big cinema run nationwide, which was going to start at the Rich Mix, and hopefully will still start at the Rich Mix in East London. And then we'd go from there to Bradford, to Brighton, to Birmingham, multiple screenings in Liverpool, Ireland, Canterbury, Edinburgh, Glasgow, and a load more dates were going to be added, and then the digital release was going to happen. But what we did was we brought the digital screening forward so that people can watch it now, just in case. And we've also let community groups use the film and do their own screenings. So there's, I don't know, 20 to 30 screenings happening within the UK and internationally out of solidarity to PA, to us, and to the film.
Right, so that's some of the filmmakers of this film called To Kill a War Machine. Absolutely fascinating and brilliant film, and let's have a listen to an extract from it now. I'll put the link to it up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It's around about an hour and a half or an hour and a quarter long, and it details a lot of the, and one of the things that they come towards the end of the film is taking a really good look of the effectiveness of Palestine Action in shutting down the Israeli war machine here in Great Britain.
Palestine Action permanently shut down Elbit's weapons factory in Oldham, the north of England. We permanently shut down their weapons factory in Tamworth in Staffordshire. We forced Elbit to abandon their London office. We forced them to lose their office in Boston in the US. Several companies have been forced to cut ties with Elbit Systems, including the property manager, Fisher German, asset manager, JLL, international lobby firm, ABCO, the landlord, London Metric, investors, Barclays Bank, machinery suppliers, Hydrofeed, international commercial law firm, MLL Legal, their recruiters, IO Associates, their website designers, Naked Creativity, and Somerset Council. They've also been forced to lose contracts worth billions of pounds, including the Watchkeeper drone project, which was led by their Leicester factory. We've seen in repeated documents Elbit complaining to UK ministers about the disruption we are causing and their failure to be able to recruit people in England as a result of our actions. And Palestine Action won't stop until every single one of Elbit's factories are forced out of the country.
You are talking about over 500 operations across these years. That is a Herculean achievement.
Well, Palestine Action, she says, will not stop. Well, Palestine Action has been stopped, but Palestine Action is not going away. Of course, it's actually rather just going to, I would imagine, just reform and change its name, that sort of thing. So anyway, that film is called To Kill a War Machine. It came out just before the ban on Palestine action, and is out there and up there on YouTube, etc. So I'll put a link up to the full version of that and downloadable, etc., on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Now, when it comes to Gaza, there's been all sorts of horrid stuff going with this GHF, the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, rather misnamed since they are one of the most disgusting killers, war machine aspects of what, everything that's going on. So the Israelis have decided they're going to control the aid, and as they control the aid, they're putting people in pens and feeding them, apparently, drugs, weird drugs that they're putting into the flour that they're feeding. This is a clip here from one of the best, fascinating and brilliant TikTokers and YouTubers and social media Twitterers from Gaza. Her name is Wizard Bizan, talking about what they've been sticking in the flour, this Israeli-American so-called aid company.
Hey. Maybe you've celebrated, just like us, that finally after 4 months of starvation, the Israeli army allowed a very limited number of flour bags to enter to the Gaza Strip. And although this flour cannot even cover 10% of the need of the starved families of Gaza Strip, we were so happy until we found that the flour was entered to a starved population by the GHF, the Israeli American Aid Distribution Foundation, was mixed with drugs. Specifically with oxycodone. What is oxycodone? An opiate. It's a very strong painkiller that cannot be used without a medical supervision, and it causes a slowdown in the heart rate, a mental illness, a damage in the brain, and most importantly, it is addictive. Now, drugs have been the ultimate way to demolish, to destroy any people for colonizers over history. Okay? Britain flooded China with opiates. Holland was the first to enter drugs to the South Africa, and Spain did the same to Latin America. So colonizers are just using the same tools, and we have their past and future plans, and yet we let everything to happen again. Israel failed for 2 years now to break the Palestinian will and to tear the social fabric. So alongside with taking over 75% or more of the land, destroying the infrastructure and the housing, starving the population, now it's the drugs. It's the drugs. People now are enforced to be addicted because the flour was mixed with not only bills, but actually there are doubts that the flour itself was mixed with drugs. Who can look at the eyes of a mother, a starving mother with starving children, to tell them, don't eat this flour? All of this is wearing a humanitarian foundation mask that is called the GHF, that was surprisingly established only weeks before the Israeli army decides to close the borders of Gaza Strip to prevent any aids from entering to the INGOs in Gaza Strip in the 1st of March 2025. Isn't that suspicious enough to you? To realize that GHF needs to be closed right now, that food must enter only by INGOs that used to work on the humanitarian context of Gaza Strip.
So that's Wizard Bizan. Put a link up to her on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. Confirmed by the Middle East Monitor, the use of oxycodone in the flour. I mean, this is obviously really disgusting, despicable and evil. So not only are people getting shot dead who are trying to get aid, they're also poisoning the aid. The flooding Gaza with oxycodone hidden in flour packages and distributed under a false pretense of humanitarian intervention feels just about right in terms of the level of depravity we've come to expect from the most moral army in the world, says Middle East Monitor. At base level, the controversy surrounding the establishment of US-Israeli aid centres to distribute aid continues to grow. To date, 549 Palestinian civilians, now it's up to 1,000 actually, are known to have been killed at these distribution sites when waiting for aid, a number that grows by the hour. Over 4,000 had been injured when this article was written, since they became operational. Mass extermination of those waiting in line. But anyway, it talks a little bit about the seeding of opiates in Gaza by the Israeli occupations is not a new allegation. The Israeli government has been accused several times over the last 20 years of flooding Gaza with drugs, specifically tramadol, in an attempt to both pacify the population and harbour addiction in the region. The issue was brought into sharp focus in a 2010 documentary that highlighted tramadol use in Gaza in the aftermath of the Israeli operation Cast Lead. So anyway, this is I'll put a link up to this article on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks ever so much for Wizard Bizan for bringing that to our attention, and obviously to the Middle East Monitor too. But as promised, let's have a listen now to former councillor Simon Killane. He looks at much wider points this week. A much longer interview, I think, is about an hour and a 10 minutes, hour and a quarter. I spoke to him yesterday about what he's seeing with the Trump and Epstein business, with the Gaza business, and how he learnt how politics in Britain really works. How could it be that our so-called democratic politicians are supporting this? Anyway, he's absolutely adamant Britain is definitely no longer a democracy. Simon Killane, he was a councillor in Malmesbury in Wiltshire, and he tried to make some changes there, and he was booted out for his, and character assassinated actually too, for his trouble.
It's hard for people to believe this. I'm not nuts. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I've got a degree in mechanical engineering. I'm a very normal, most of us are a very normal sort of practical guy, you know? I realized that for the period of the 8 years I was a councillor, when I got to this point, sort of for the first 5 or 6 years where I was just doing local stuff, I wasn't really influencing maybe somebody's, you know, making sure we could fix some potholes in the streets and some policy on various things around the town and maybe influencing some things on a county level. But I wasn't influencing the money. I wasn't influencing somebody's investment of hundreds of thousands, but probably millions. And what happened, the papers were really good to me. They'd always publish really great little articles. Simon done this, Simon got the opening of this centre. We got a new, extra care. There's this, there's that happening. And they'd ask me questions and I'd put some comments in and I had a great relationship. As soon as I got involved with these big decisions, and I was not willing to bring in these special interests or get into bed with these special interests, all of the newspapers completely turned against me. Right, and for me it was odd because I thought, well, what's going on at the time? What's going on here? It's almost like, what have I done? And so even the new news reporters who were very kind just disappeared. So there were a lot of these young reporters because they can't afford to have reporters on these newspapers these days, and they change over a lot. But basically, the newspapers, it became a complete teardown. So I had, I think I had 13 code of conduct applications. So people in the town and the area had put in a complaint to the council about things.
So you've gone from hero to zero. But look, we've only got a couple of minutes left.
Hero to zero. So
try and bring this back
in a nutshell. The newspapers,
the big stuff. Can you try and bring this back to the big stuff, Trump? And how does this all translate into a bigger international?
Because it's exactly the same playbook. It's just a different scale, right? It's exactly the same playbook. What's really happening here is that all of the politicians that have really critical positions in the US are puppets. Right. And so basically there's a bunch of people behind the scenes, very rich, very intelligent and very narcissistic people, probably known this for generations. Those people control everything that's going on. They choose the politicians. They chose Obama. They choose Bush and all these people. Trump was a bit of an anomaly because Trump had his own money and social media and Rogan and all those crazy, very interesting, crazy people supported Trump and Trump got in. But Trump is very difficult to control. I know, I met these people. They want somebody they can control. Either they control them by having information about them, their sex life, their past life, criminal activity. So basically they say, you do what we tell you, or we will spill the beans.
You know, last week when he was interviewed, Trump said in a quite humble voice, he said, I trust hardly anyone, to be honest with you. And they were,
he doesn't trust anybody.
Putin, but he's saying he doesn't even trust the people surrounding him at the White House.
He doesn't trust anybody, and the people who control the system don't trust anybody either. They're ruthless. people. They're so, and but they're also very intelligent. See, this is my opinion. Trump's not an intelligent man. That's my honest opinion. He's absent-minded. He makes mistakes. He doesn't understand politics. He doesn't understand diplomacy. Anything like that. To the controllers that I met, he would not be chosen to be a president or a prime minister. They would think he's too much. He's too unhinged. He's too much of a liability. And so what will happen is they'll have gone along. You see what's happened with Trump. A lot of the things he said he would do after he got elected, he's not doing because he's being manipulated. It's like, well, Ukraine, you know, you said you'd end the war. Well, we can't. We can't do it. And he's coming out and you see all these confusing decisions because they also play him. He is like, he's easy to play. Trump is the easiest guy in the world to play to these people. So Donald Trump, in my view, would not be chosen by the people who behind the scenes who control everything because he is, first of all, too unstable. He's too unpredictable. There, it's difficult to control him because he has his own money. You see, you need to have somebody who you basically finance. But also the interesting thing is you also need to have lots of dirt on them. And clearly there's dirt on Trump and it's coming out. So, just from an analogy point of view, imagine you're driving a car at 80 miles an hour on the road and Trump is driving and he's drunk and people in the car, there's a mother and a baby and others say, we need to get rid of this guy. And they focus on him and they throw him out the window and they get rid of him. They need to remember that the steering wheel is not being controlled by him. There are people hidden in the car who they've never seen who are controlling the car. He's just a figurehead. He's just a puppet. And as soon as he's gone, they will choose somebody else to replace him. And it will be either Democrats or Republicans. The political parties, just like the UK, they're just a sham. You know, the Liberals and the Conservatives got together to have a coalition and basically just carved out a whole pile of contracts that they were going to offer to each other as reward. Got rid of, you know, you remember the student fees, brought in the student fees, huge amounts of money went into pockets of people from that, the loans and everything else the students have to get. So the problem for the people is they're so brainwashed by PR people to focus on what, on an effect of a core problem. And the core problem is these people who control everything. What we need to do is pick them out, put the spotlight on them and say, you're the guys doing this. Because it doesn't matter what you do in the US. Every president, you've seen it already, every time they have a new president, it's another guy that somebody has out of a queue of people who is inappropriate and would never be a good president in the first place.
Okay, well, look, can you pick out a few names? We've got obviously the Conservative and Labour Party slightly fading away, even though the Labour Party are in power because of their credibility. Lib Dems doing quite well and the Greens doing quite well out of it. And obviously Reform UK with Farage. So can you name a few names of people you think are behind the scenes of these parties?
Well, I could name names. I don't really want to name names, to be honest. But I would say to you is about Farage and people like that is that's another sham. You just get people who are upset putting right-wing, what's perceived to be right-wing, because right-wing is another PR term, into power. A good example is Wiltshire Council. Wiltshire Council is now run by the Liberals, right, because of Farage. Because his party gained enough seats to stop the Conservatives from getting a majority. That council is going to go through hell. Because the Liberals will basically try to make sure that any contracts, any money that was going Conservative way will go their way. And I'm not talking about the Liberal Party members and the good people of the party, but the people who control stuff. All the big contracts in the council will now be twisted to go into somebody else's pocket. The Conservatives will do everything they can to destroy the reputation and destroy any achievements the Liberals get, which means that the people of Wiltshire get nothing. So the whole thing with Farage for a county council is a complete sham and a waste of time. The other thing I'd say to you is that what I learned, and it's so frustrating, what I learned about the system is that the big question is, how do you fix it? It's so easy to fix. To fix a political system and make it work is the simplest thing ever. And everybody I say this to says to me, you're rubbish, it can't be. It is. It's simple. It's one of the problems that these people who run the system have diverted us into nonsense. And they know that it's simple to fix. And the person who comes up and says, do these three or four things and you can fix your political system, that person will be killed. It's a very simple. Let me just give you one example. The House of Lords in London. The House of Lords is a bunch of people who are basically getting positions and being called lords, which is ridiculous in itself, because they give money to the political party and they've got businesses and connections. They're supposed to be a scrutiny chamber. They're supposed to scrutinise the policies of government. It's impossible to scrutinise policies of government that way. It's like having a referee in a football match who's paid by, you know, bungs by each team and by people who are sitting in the audience. It would never work. In a football match, football team organisation, the whole thing would collapse. What would you do? You'd say, OK, let's have a proper scrutiny chamber with elected independent members that can scrutinise the policies of the government. And let's build a new parliament, say, in Birmingham or somewhere else. Pay your MPs bloody good salaries on condition that there's no more private funding, no more links to private businesses, no more lobbyists coming into government, all this sort of stuff. You know, fund your political system through tax, not through private means. And all of this, within 5 years, you will have a system of politics which is hundreds of times more democratic and decent and honourable. But I tell you that trying to get that simple message across to the people would result in the death of a person. If they managed to convince the public that it was simple to fix the political system and make it work, and that you could get elected representatives which are honest. You see, the other problem is they've convinced everybody that they can never have representatives that work for them because everybody thinks politicians are corrupt. There is no such thing as a politician. It's a made-up word. When I was in politics, I was an engineer with a father and a family man who just wanted to represent the community I was living in. I never felt like a politician from the day I walked in there. But what they've done is, through PR, they've made us believe that there's no possibility you could be represented because these politicians are corrupt. It's nonsense. So if I could convince the public and I could get them to believe what I'm saying, my life would be at risk. I'm not joking you, because they'd realise they were caught.
I mean, you do wonder sometimes if you could almost pick people at random and put them into political power looking after these big budgets, that they might do a better job, Simon.
Well, if you're a doctor in Bath RUH, working for 25 years, or surgeon and so on, surely you really could potentially be a great minister for health. Right? You want to make sure that these people who've got experience and knowledge can get into the system. But the problem is, you have to run a campaign, especially in America, make a ton of money for you to get into the system. Let me tell you something else as well. You don't even need, this is what's crazy, you don't even need to come up with new ideas. All you need to do is look at all the different political systems around the world with people who are analytical and fact-based and evidence-based and not full of tribalism and everything else and say, okay, did that work? Did that work in Holland? Did that work in Sweden? Did that work in Norway? Because they're all slightly different. A good example is in Australia. The regional councils have no political parties. So basically, if you're in the Wiltshire Council equivalent or the Bristol Council equivalent in Australia, there's no political parties on those councils. They're all independents and they form groups and they work for their area. And it works perfectly well. It doesn't work any worse than here, because what'll happen is here they'll say, oh, independence, an independent can't influence policy. I learned that an independent MP or an independent councillor is highly powerful. They're highly powerful people because they're not beholden to the party, and the party completely controls the MPs. Literally, as soon as an MP says, you know, I have an idea that I want to do this or that, and it goes against the party rules, they'll either be convinced not to do it, they'll either be threatened that they'll withdraw funding and they won't get nominated.
But you see, Farage is almost riding to power on this idea that his party is a political revolution, that he's going to reopen the steelworks, the coal mines in South Wales, that he's going to force the city not to pay interest on the big bond loans that they're taking. He's going to be changing, doing all the things.
It's rubbish. He's another Trump. What he's doing is, he's also a businessman, he's a financier, he's probably made a ton of money out of Brexit and all his finances. He's not to be trusted, he's a political animal, and what you're doing is you're not actually fixing the machine. What you're doing is just changing another, you're putting another puppet in. And the other thing, what will happen is, he will become pivotal. So he'll become pivotal as to who gets elected because his number of seats will grow. And what will happen is, the guys behind the scenes with all their money and power will manipulate. They'll manipulate to find ways to infiltrate the people who are in his party or to get somebody else to take over from him. Until you cut the rot out of the system, until you say, political, you know, J.D. Vance, right? J.D. Vance would not be the the vice president of America, if it wasn't for a guy, I think his surname is Thiel. Have you heard of him? So he's a multi-billionaire financier in the US who paid for all of Vance's campaign. Right? That's how Vance got to be the vice president. He didn't get to be vice president because he was a cool guy who'd done loads of things for his community and knew a lot about, you know, the system he was working in and foreign affairs and government and so on. He did it through the money from a guy. If you go on YouTube and watch Thiel, he's unhinged. Thiel even has said something of akin to, he doesn't really care about civilization when it comes to AI. Whether it lives or dies. He's the guy who funded Vance, right? And Vance goes around the place going, "Oh, I believe in fairness." And Vance is there because of the money.
Well, Thiel has also been recently. He did a two-part talk. I think it was about 2 months ago or so, talking about the Antichrist and saying, yes. "Well, actually, the Antichrist is sort of some sort of figure that's coming along soon to stir things up." Well, I mean, Peter Thiel, it does seem to be very, very powerful and influential, but no one's elected him. He's someone that's ridden this whole idea of the change in the banking system. No doubt he and others will be making an absolute fortune out of these cryptocurrencies and any kind of reform that there is in banking. Yes. So who is Thiel?
And they made their money. He made his money out of, his family made their money out of, you know, mining in Africa and slave labor. They're imperialists as well. They go back a long, long way in this whole kind of, you know, this whole kind of scenario. So none of these people are to be trusted. And the problem is that mechanistically, you can easily fix a political system. I know you can, right? But the person who can convince the public to do it will be at great risk. And it's trying to convince a brainwashed public who are being fed all sorts of diversionary tactics and misinformation. The reason why today, you know, you look at Gaza and you look at what's going on in Gaza. There's so much confusion about what's going on. There's so much. You see the lobby. You see the great example of the people behind. You say mention names. Just go to the big lobby groups who are funding the political parties in the US, who are the Israeli Jews. So there are particular people within those organizations who have more power than Trump. It's clear. They're basically driving this policy of genocide in Israel. And it doesn't matter what people do. People can campaign in the streets till the cows come home. They can pour blood over the White House. In fact, what will happen is the more people campaign in the streets, the more it will give the government an excuse to curtail their rights to free speech and to campaign. You see that's happening in the UK at the moment.
Well, look, I mean, you're saying it's easy to fix, and then you're also saying it's almost impossible.
It's culturally, that's the problem. And I think what's happening, it's very interesting. I have a very different view about what's going on in the US. The US is beginning to have a democracy. I know this sounds crazy, but just hear me out. The US, it's like a design process. The US, with the internet and so on, people starting to get information, start thinking, our system is corrupt. We need somebody different. And they get the wrong guy. They get the wrong guy. They think we'll have a black guy because he's cool and he's equal rights and all this stuff. They realize that there's more racial conflict in the US now, and Obama was basically bought as well. Saying we'll have this independent financial guy Trump, who's an alpha male. But the people of America, you can see, just look at Tucker Carlson and others now who are very MAGA, very sort of, you know, pro-Trump. They're all leaving Trump, and they're all beginning to realize that's not the answer. We need a different kind of system. But they haven't quite got to it. You see, Elon Musk is going to set a party up. Well, he's a billionaire. He's unhinged himself. He's got loads of issues, personal issues. But you can see that there's a struggle going on in that country where people say, it isn't quite right, but we need to find a way to create something that works. So I think we're moving in that direction. But unfortunately, there are problems. And the most major problem is that these people behind the scenes have got their hands on their grip firmly on technology. AI and the advancement of AI is totally unhinged. Nobody knows what they're doing. These people who are obsessed about AI are a lot of them, like Thiel, are putting tons of money into a race with China for weaponry and dominance and military. It's all about the military. And also another massive problem that's happening is there's absolutely no discussion about what is happening to the internet, because what's happening to the internet is that, The podcaster I watched last week, who I thought was very interesting and was telling me really interesting stuff, there'll be a million of those guys on it in 6 months' time because they'll all be faked by AI. We will get to a point on the internet where there is no truth. The AI will be so good at fakery that basically we will not be able... Tony Gosling, there'll be 1,000 Tony Goslings. And there'll be Tony Goslings on there saying things, death to Jews, you know, I support Hitler, kill the Irish. It'll be all sorts of crazy stuff. And these people who are behind the scenes know this. Because it's exactly again what happened to me when I was in the council. Once you get your foot in the door and they realise you've got the door opened, they will regroup and think, how the hell do we stop this? And a brilliant way to stop truth is to fill the internet with lies. You just look at the moment. No one is doing anything about the fact that somebody could take your brilliant podcast that you do where you reveal some really good truths about what's going on locally or regionally. And if they knew you were going to create some trouble or you were going to virally be successful, there's nothing stopping them from creating 1,000 Tony Goslings, all with different messages, so that people, when they go on there, have no idea who's the real one and who's the false one. Right? So that's another problem we've got, is that people, we have to wake up in society and realise that actually the problems are really easy to solve. The people behind it are making it look like they're impossible to solve. They're driving us against each other, and they're also now latching on to technology, which will give them all sorts of tools to basically try and restrict our freedoms and will pollute the internet with absolutely packs of lies.
Well, look, okay, so this is a bit of a dystopia you're promoting here. It may be it's much more real than we're getting from anybody else, Simon. But we do need to know from you as an engineer, you're connecting the wires, you're connecting the pipes in the engine. How do we fix it? Let's have that in a nutshell, if you can.
Very simple. Very simple. First thing you do is you take. Well, I to fix it. Simple rules. First of all, councils, regional councils, no longer have political parties. You break the link between political parties and national parties because the national parties don't have any interest. The MP who works in Sheffield, who's head of planning or finance or gives the money to councils, has no interest in what goes on in Bristol, and it's corrupt. That's one. The second thing you do is you pay your politicians really good salaries. But they only work for the people. They have to give up all their interests, special interests, business links, the works, and they have to be published. They also have to publish any membership of any organisation that they're in. So it's everybody can see. Next thing you do is no more private funding of political campaigns, all done through taxation. So they work for the people. They're paid for by the people, right? So when it comes to elections, there's a leaf that goes through the door showing all the candidates, what they stand for and so on. None of it is carried out through private money. Private money is a poison. Lobbying. Ban all lobbying at government level. No lobbying. You should not allow private companies to have influence on Parliament inside the doors of Parliament. You set up a proper scrutiny chamber, which has independent members. Probably what you do is you nominate them from retired professional industries. So if it's health, if it's finance, whatever, you get these people. You get rid of all the Lords. You get rid of the monarchy in the UK. That's a bygone era. It does not represent fairness or equality. I know people love this thing, oh, the Queen, King and the Queen. It's nonsense. Complete nonsense. You set up a new parliament somewhere in the middle of the UK with modern offices, modern accommodation and so on. And you make the parliament in London a nice tourist attraction. And then another thing you do is, through your scrutiny process, you basically look at all of the other parliaments around Europe and other places, and you go out there and you say, let's see what they did on this particular mechanism or that particular mechanism, and let's see if we can trial it here. So we'll always be constantly improving and improving our democracy and so on.
Okay, so is this inside or outside the European Union, or doesn't it matter?
Well, it doesn't matter, but the European Union is highly corrupt, right? That's the other problem. The European Union is very, very corrupt. There's not, you know, how do you rate democracy when the people often who are representing you in the European Union are not even elected? Von der Leyen, you know, this lady who runs around the place touting war, she's not been elected by anybody. It's a huge, corrupt organisation full of lobbyists. And it's also heavily corrupted by the US. I would guarantee you that most of the countries, and you can see this, you can see it, just watch the way the European Union literally licks the of the US politicians, even if they dislike them. The US with its clever CIA tactics and its business and its manipulation, its money, I believe has totally infiltrated pretty much all of the European countries. So that the politicians, you know, the first thing they'll do is before they get out and make a decision or say something, they'll say, what does the US think? Is it okay for us to do this? Should we consider whether we're doing it or not doing it? Right down to the point of murder, latent murder of people like you see in Gaza.
Yeah, so, in the background to all of this, of course, the Chinese are inscrutably sitting there with their hands folded, watching the West almost implode on itself.
Completely. And what's the mad part of this is, you've never, ever needed, yeah, I'm sorry, you've desperately needed an American and Europe that was highly democratic, highly people-focused, fair, you know, working to try and make society better, improve technology, healthcare, and so on. Because the alternative is going to be for us is a completely dysfunctional shamocracy that gets basically pipped by a regime in China or in Russia that we have no idea about, that we don't know anything about how they elect their leaders. What, you know, what democracy is there? And do they care about us? No, they don't.
Well, there is a democracy in Russia, actually. Like, we Russia, keep getting perhaps. Told there yes. isn't one in Russia. We You're keep right. getting told there's no democracy in Iran. We were also yes. told there was no democracy in Syria. These three are all lies.
Yes. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that there's no reason to believe that they have our interests at heart and that they're any better than us. But we need to have, you know, that kind of doesn't really matter. It's not a problem. If we in Europe and America had a decent democratic process, you know, we're screwed, basically. Because if they have a great democracy there, okay, we'll be okay. But the reality is they don't care about us. You know, the Chinese, basically, want to sell products to us. And we're basically trying to screw them over with tariffs under the guise that they're stealing, you know, stealing manufacturing and flooding our countries with goods that basically are cheaper and so on. I was a product designer for 20 years. We gave it all away. I spent 20 years of my life taking designs of products and stuff that we had developed over decades and saying, just give it to Chinese because they can make it cheap. Why? Because they were using cheap labor. The West gave everything to China, and China's just doing what any country would have done. They've thought, well, we don't really need to work through them. Why don't we just set up our own companies? Why don't we just make it and brand it with our own brand? And now, because the Chinese have got an autonomy and they're moving really fast with technology because they learned everything that the West had done and they're doing a great job, we in the West have decided, oh, well, you know, free trade and fair trade is no longer acceptable. We have to basically say, make up a story that the Chinese basically stole it all from us or are trying to, you know, take over. The Chinese are just trying to basically compete. And also, we were quite happy to basically buy cheap Chinese goods for decades when we had control, when they were making the components for us to put into our products. As soon as they started taking that control away, that became a problem. And that's at the core of what's going on in the world.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a similar thing in a weird way, haven't we, with King Charles. No one elects him. Same with President Xi.
Madness.
I mean, they've basically created in China a kind of monarchy, really.
Yes, but the reality is, I don't know enough about China. I would definitely say that, you know, is it the pot calling the kettle black? We do not have a functioning democracy in the UK. And the other problem is, if you go into the street and you ask people, what is democracy? They can't tell you. People, the PR machine will give you these sound bites. But in reality, what is democracy? And, you know, I always relate democracy to a referee in a, you know, Chelsea versus Man United, a Wembley Stadium. And the referee is on the pitch and the referee is getting paid very little. He's getting paid of peanuts, but he's receiving bungs from people behind the two teams. And there are also lobby groups within the audience who's receiving bungs for. So basically no one can trust any decision he makes. Right. And that's the problem. You know, if you look at the football system, I say to how easy is to fix this? You'd never do it. You'd never do the same kind of structure with a football team. You'd have a referee who says, okay, I mean, some people don't like refs. What I'm saying is, in general, you have somebody who's not corruptible and makes decent decisions. The other very simple thing is, I was in the private sector for years. I never saw a situation ever where a board of directors would employ a new sales director and pay him, say, 20 grand a year or 30 grand a year when when the other companies were paying 100,000, right, and a commission, and then say to him, oh, you can work for us, but you can also work for our competitor down the road. It would never work. That's what MPs do. MPs get paid in real terms. They're running huge budgets. They get paid 60, 70 grand or something like that. And then what happens is they go off and they get the millions from all these lobby groups and special interests, which is works totally against...
Yeah, I mean, what you're describing here is a cartel system, really. It's like...
It's a cartel.
Yeah, it is a cartel.
And they know this. By the way, if you said to the businessmen who are behind the curtain here and running things, if you said to those businessmen, now I want you to run your multi-million pound business that you're using to gain influence from the political system, I want you to run it exactly how Parliament runs, they'd laugh at you. They'd say, no way. It would never work. It's rubbish. I'm not going to set up a mini House of Lords with people I pay to scrutinise what business decisions we make. I'm not going to pay my directors this money and then let them work for my competitors. They'd never allow it. So what I'm saying, from that simplicity, the very people who are running the show know it's dysfunctional, because what they're doing is they're leeching off the political system. They're leeching off of it for their businesses. Instead, what should be happening is, you say, almost like the business of government is to be an independent policy setting organization that works for the people. The people are your employers and you work for them. And if you mess up, they can get rid of you and they pay you and they state that and they pay you handsomely. But you have no, you're not contaminated by working for anybody else. It's easy, easy, easy to do. But you've, as I say, you've got to convince a public that has been so brainwashed. I mean, the very last thing, I went to a school when I was a councillor. I was standing to be an MP. And I was standing to be an independent, and I could not get to go to schools. They said, well, if you're an independent, you're not with a party, you're not allowed. You're not allowed to come. And eventually I got to go to this one school. And when I got to this school and I went in and I started speaking, the children in the school and the teachers, these were teenagers. So these were like, you know, 13, 14 year olds. They were already brainwashed. Oh, my dad's UKIP. Oh, my dad is Conservative. My dad's Labour. How could an independent have any say? When I said to them, what do you know about politics and electoral representation? They said, well, Labour do this and the Conservative. It was all party politics. I said to them, who actually manages the finance of your school? None of them could tell me. I said, if you had a basketball court out there and the basketball hoop was broken or something, how could you get it replaced if there was no money directly to replace it? No answer. Who would fund it? No answer. I said, have you heard of area boards? No. I said, do you know you can get 20 or 30,000 off an area board from the council to spend on things that for the community you could get your basketball hoop replaced? Do you know that the councils have a contract with a private financing company that runs your whole school and even gets to support the toilet rolls delivered here? No. So the students knew nothing about learning about the mechanism of representation, how you could influence it, but they were completely brainwashed already on party politics. And they looked at me and there was no way I convinced them to say, you're an independent. You have no. You'll never be able to do anything, right? You know? And you couldn't convince them. And even the teachers, you couldn't convince.
Wow, so the that's a bit of an uphill struggle. You're right. But anyway, look. So if people are interested in finding you and following you on social media, etc., Simon, can they do that?
Yes, I have. I have a YouTube channel. It's called Nugget of Wisdom. It gets very few viewers, so, but it's my attempt to try and express this. I do feel that what I'm expressing it's before its time, unfortunately, that it's going to take a lot of really difficult awakenings for people to realise that what I'm saying is actually true, right? And that it's all, and also positive. There's so much negativity. The system's corrupt, the political system's broken, there's nothing you can do. That's what these people want us all to believe. The reality is we are living in potentially the most fantastic time ever. If we could look at it and say, look, let's sit around the table, let's figure out how we can fix it, we could do amazing things really quickly. And as I say, it's the reason why I was so targeted with an incredible hate campaign. Because as soon as these people realised that when I was in scrutiny, I could sit round with the Labour guys and the Conservative guys and the UKIP guys and say, look, we need to sort out this policy. What could we do? And bring them in. And they said, gosh, this is the first time this has ever happened. Before, we couldn't do it.
Do you think the leeches are going to go out to grass or into jail?
I think the problem is the leeches, just like Trump, they go into jail, but some of the leech comes out in their place. The people behind the scenes will make a sacrifice. They don't care. They'll make a sacrifice of Trump or whoever it might be, and the people will have their egos triggered and go, oh, we hated him, he was terrible. You see this a lot. They will say, it's this person. This person is the reason why everything's gone bad. And they'll say to that person, I'm sorry, mate, but you're a sacrificial lamb. There's nothing we can do. We'll see what we can do for you when you get out of prison. We'll sort out your family or whatever. But in reality, the people then think it's all fixed. Nothing's fixed. They're still there. They're still running the show. It's just another person now in the queue will take over that position. That's what's happening. You'll see it next election. What'll happen? A democratic, chisel-jawed, cool guy who helped to oust Trump and covered some of the paedophilic stuff that was going on will suddenly become the hero and will be the next president. And he'll be as corrupt as hell, or he'll be bought because they have something on him. You've got to go and focus on these people, and they leave a trail. It's money. Basically, look at all the campaigns of these politicians and who is funding them. Look at the companies they're connected to, and you'll find the people. You don't need the names.
You do, in a way. Peter Thiel, definitely one of them.
Yeah, the Israeli lobby. If you want to find out who's really calling the shots, it's the people who are pumping the money from these Israeli lobbies into the US government to fund their campaigns. It's not Netanyahu. It's not Trump. It's people you've never heard of in that Israeli lobby who are multimillionaires, who've got strong footing in politics, who are probably linked to people like Mossad, have a whole lot of dirt that they've picked out on people who have done, behaved badly or whatever. So they've got those people bought and are pumping money into political campaigns. You can find those people. It's not that difficult. And you see in the US, they're beginning to sort of realize, you hear it all the time, Israel is running the US. Why is Israel running the US? Because they're beginning to realize that there's people behind the scenes who are more important than Trump or Starmer. Seriously, is Starmer running anything in the UK? Starmer is running nothing. He's a puppet, a complete puppet. And we all know this. Jeremy Corbyn was, in my view, maybe I'm wrong, he was a decent guy who probably had the best. He was an anomaly again in the Labour Party. When the Labour Party was struggling, they were fed up with the chisel-jawed guys, the Tony Blairs, who promised lots and did a lot of bad stuff. Along comes Corbyn, and then Corbyn gets ousted with a whole campaign, a hate campaign against him about him being anti-Semitic. So you can see the system needs to change. Getting rid of the people is a complete waste of time. It just opens up opportunities for more, and it satisfies the public. The public are fooled into thinking, crucify Trump on a cross and show some pictures of him abusing young children. The public will just go crazy, and they'll be glad that he's gone. But they'll have done nothing to fix the system. Nothing. It'll still continue. You'll still have somebody else. Gavin Newsom. Somebody else will come along who's basically pretending to work for the people. And he won't. And they won't. That's why also people say it never changes. It can't change unless the actual machine, the engine, is re-engineered. And it's easy to do.
Well, that's good to hear, Simon Killane. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, and thank you so much for giving me the time to at least express some of this. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Simon.
Cheers.
So, Simon Killane there. I'll put the full version. You can't believe it, but that is only about the last one third of quite a long interview where Simon is really pouring his heart out as someone that can see it very clearly what's going on around us, the way that democracy has been strangled, and also clearly how to sort it out. But to be honest with you, he seems to be one of the only voices saying these things. Get rid of the lobbies. We need to be paying politicians. And of course the mainstream press are not saying any of what he's saying at all, because they're part of the problem. They're part of the system. Mainstream media, wouldn't it be lovely to have a sort of, to hear Simon for a couple of weeks on one of these evening news programmes every week doing a news review. In fact, I think I'm encouraged to invite him on here more regularly to give us a take on what's been going on in the news internationally, because he has seen it right up close and personal, right in his face. And he had a horrific character assassination campaign against him, including some basic stuff like women phoning up his home, leaving messages for him on their answer phone, who were pretending to be his mistresses, so that this would seed hatred between him and his wife, and mistrust and this sort of thing. So this is the techniques that people have been using to really destroy someone like Simon, who was actually a very honest and decent politician in Malmesbury in Wiltshire, and on Wiltshire County Council too. What interesting and fantastic lessons Simon Killane will teach us. If you have a listen to the longer show, that will be up tonight, the longer interview tonight at thisweek.org.uk. So we're going to have a quick reprise to last week's RIP Mark Saunders. If you weren't listening last week, Mark was a documentary filmmaker and anarchist who died a week before last now. Rather suddenly, unexpectedly, I realised I'd actually been chatting to him on WhatsApp just a few weeks before, back in June, about his this something called the Docklands Museum. That's in Canary Wharf area, where you can just hop off the Docklands Light Railway or the tube there, and it's a well worth spending a whole day there if you're ever in London. The Docklands Museum takes you through the whole history of the Docklands and the Royal Docks, the biggest docks in the entire world, that were slowly enough dismantled after World War II, along with the rest of Britain, basically, and now has been populated with the so-called financial empire, which has really sprung out from the city. But it's a brilliant and part of that museum focuses on the Wapping dispute, Rupert Murdoch moving his print works over to Wapping, and all the battles going on in the 1980s with the print workers and the electricians trade union scabbing, taking over from the printers. And lots of stuff to do with that in the museum in this particular section. But what I'd done is I'd spotted Mark's film, a poster of the premiere of Mark's film Despite the Sun, in there. Despite the Sun obviously is a film about the Wapping dispute. And he said, wow, I'd not seen that for ages, and pinged me back saying, is it part of a permanent exhibition? I told him, of course, that it was, and pinged him a few other pictures from the exhibition. But that sadly passed away this month, the month after I sent that to him. So, but anyway, we had some people last week, old friends of Mark's, colleagues of Mark's, talking. He ran something called Spectacle Productions. His original time I first came across him in the late 1980s was something called Despite TV, based in Tower Hamlets in East London. And Despite TV were producing documentaries for Channel 4. This is the way television worked in the late 80s, where if you had a little video workshop or collective or co-op, you could make films that would go on TV, and Mark was doing that. Things like Despite the City, a whole film about the City of London and its influence on EastEnders and East London, and also some very deep insight, which we heard last week, from David Yallop speaking on one of his documentaries, that Despite the City one. But he also did the famous, in some circles anyway, Battle of Trafalgar film about the poll tax riots, which explains how the police provoked those riots, and that was at the time, really very, very quickly after the events, disentangled the lies, the propaganda that had been spoken by the Metropolitan Police and by the mainstream press about what had happened at the poll tax riot in 1990, as well as he also did a film called The Truth Lies in Rostock, about just in the 1990s after the fall of the Berlin Wall, where the government, the state in East Germany, the newly liberated state in East Germany, was helping organise race riots against migrant workers. So you had this kind of neo-Nazi factions being helped by... Anyway, we're going to hear a clip from that in a minute, but the other film that Mark made, and he made many, but one of the most powerful was called Exodus, Movement of Jar People. And this was about the Exodus Collective in Luton. They were running free parties, doing a very successful job of it. And so I spoke earlier this week to someone else who worked quite closely with Mark Saunders, and that is a guy called Glenn Jenkins from Marsh Farm Estate, and also from the Exodus Collective, because as in the longer interview Glenn explains, Mark just basically turned up at one of their raves, started and used his one of his documentaries as a pass to get in to one of these free parties, and struck up a great friendship with Glenn and the Exodus Collective. I ended up making a film, a Channel 4 commissioned a film all about it. And so let's have a listen to Glenn Jenkins now reporting a little bit about his relationship with Mark Saunders, and also about the Luton scene back in 1991 that Mark turned up in.
In Luton, there was a mass of empty warehouses, hospices, buildings all over the shop, just derelict, you know, because of the wind down of manufacturing from the town, and empty farms and all sorts of things. And we were a group of long-term unemployed people. I'd been a train driver and come out of that when they privatised it, and ended up kind of like as part of this unemployed pool of people who were excluded from pretty much everything due to skintness, you know, financial exclusion, social exclusion. And after a long period of that, you kind of get your own shit together. And another part of our life was free parties, Spiral Tribe, all of that, the Convoy, Stonehenge. You know, I mean, we were going to festivals because they were free, and so therefore you can get in, and beautiful, you know. And so all of that, if you put all that in a bag, we kind of made a stand in Luton ourselves, because all of those scenes were getting closed down by police and helicopters and dogs and horses, and it just went mad. The whole rave scene, they were crushing it to, you know, particularly the outdoor scene. So we kind of decided on June the 5th, 92, we'd put our own sounds on and make a stand in our own town. And the rest was history, man. We did it on June the 5th, 92, to demonstrate the need. We said to them, that's what we're doing, and we were occupying this land to do that. And 6 months later, it was 10,000 people. So, you know, it grew exponentially, man. It was outstripped what I thought would happen. And there began Exodus movement of Jah people with the social stuff. You know, we were playing these venues and thinking, this is too good to leave, because the big numbers of people in the house were at best sofa surfing and at worst homeless, you know. So we started occupying these derelict sites all throughout Luton and turning them into not only dance sites for the night, you know, a temporary autonomous zone, we'd call that, but we would occupy them and start using for jobs and housing and, you know, the things we were all lacking. And it just took off, tone, you know what I mean? And Mark, having read this article, came to Luton, and because Mark is Mark, you know, uniquely sort of like not only brilliant but politically spot on, do you know what I mean? Like astute as you like, studying the scene, you know, knew all of it. I was just so impressed with this guy, man. You know what I mean? And he understood us better than we understood us, if you know what I mean, because we were doing it from necessity driven. Jim Squall Carey used to say, necessity breeds ingenuity, you know, and we were doing it from that end, from being skinned, excluded out. It weren't like a academic thing or anything like that, but Mark was linked into that world, you know, of academia and urban regeneration and all of this, yeah. So he kind of understood us before we did. And it led to Mark being, I ain't lying when I say Mark become part of the collective, really. He was with us all the time, filming everything, you know. Not only, he filmed everything from us crocking venues to get in there, through to police surrounding the station, when they nicked us, the whole crowd surround the station in a non-violent protest, legendary stuff. And Mark was there all the way through, filming the whole thing, you know. And a load of the social stuff we were doing, the squats and the kind of, you know, social justice campaigns against exclusion and police corruption and all of these things that come out from a lively dance-based sort of social justice-based group, yeah.
So that's Glenn Jenkins speaking to me earlier this week about Mark Saunders and his work as a documentary filmmaker. The film he's talking about there is Exodus, Movement of Jah People, honourably and wonderfully, diligently recorded and turned into our wonderful film. Really uplifting, actually, about how people who are in a situation with no money can suddenly make their own parties Have loads of fun, and become a bit of and also, of course, bring people together in a city, in a town, Luton, where there are all sorts of divisions. And actually, isn't it interesting how Tommy Robinson and his mates all turned up in Luton to try and poison things a few years after that? Because Luton was seen as a place where the Muslim community and indigenous local community were very, very close, and had been brought together as teenagers through a lot of it through these raves that were being organised by Glenn and his friends, and diligently documented by Mark Saunders. So let's have a clip now from another one of Mark's films. It's called The Truth Lies in Rostock. I remember Mark badgering me, saying, "Tony, you really got to see this film." And I was like, "Well, this is not about the better have a watch." And of course, he was right. A fascinating film. It's mostly actually in German with subtitles, but here's a bit of the film Truth Lies in Rostock, made in 1993, about the state instigated race riots in a city in the north of a newly unified Germany.
Under Article 16 of the German Constitution, a person politically or religiously persecuted may enter Germany. The right of political asylum is not automatic. Refugees must apply and endure a lengthy and bureaucratic process. Even if allowed to stay, under Article 116, they, their children, and their children's children remain foreigners. Zast, the Central Reception Center for Refugees in Lichtenhagen, was simply the first step. People had to wait outside for days without food or money before being registered and then sent to other hostels.
So that's just a little clip. It gives you an idea of what that documentary is about. I found it absolutely fascinating to see the evidence that the state was very much involved in fomenting race riots, the neo-Nazi German state, in the year 1993. In fact, some of that was recorded in 1992, just a couple of years after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And the Nazis were in the state, or the neo-Nazis were in the state in Germany, already trying to get poor black people fighting poor white people. Well done, Mark, for investigating and documenting all of that. The Truth Lies in Rostock is the film. I'll put a link up on our show page to it at thisweek.org.uk later. But let's have another listen to Glenn now, final look at Mark Saunders, where he talks about the quarries and about the various places that they used to do these free parties. I put it to him, I said, "Well, look, how can you do a free party with thousands of people there but no toilets?"
A lot of the time, we're in quarries and things like that, yeah? So toilet, point taken, we didn't have bags of mobile toilets, you know what I mean, like you'd need to do it legally. But it was a protest, Tony, you know, a contest, we would say. You know, so half of the point was, our demand was that we've got the right to have this properly equipped, yeah? But until we get that right, without putting hundreds of thousands of pounds bills in front of us, we're going to do this to the best of our ability without that infrastructure being there to the fullness, yeah? And I ain't lying when I tell you that. That involved, like, walking around with a fireman, you know. Although we had a lot of confrontation with the police, we were proper responsible with that and saying, "Look, you know, come and check it out, mate," you know. And the fireman said to me, "This is the most safest unlicensed event he'd ever seen." Because we did have first aid, because we did have peace stewards, because we did have people who know about infrastructure and electrics and building and all of those things, scaffolding, the lot. So it ain't like we're just turning up and not concerning ourselves with infrastructure. And this is one of the things that attracted Mark, because Mark's an anarchist, man, and do you know what I mean? So order without, you know, needing to be led. This whole example of people breaking into separate activities within, when you're occupying a dance site and the police are at the door and there's hundreds of you in there, because there's hundreds of people doing stack, putting up coat room, putting up the bar, putting up the lights, but there's dozens of people buzzing around like ants. That level of self-organization under pressure was like a pressure cooker of learning. And when you are under pressure, you learn on the job. And Mark was he loved that, do you know what I mean? Because and we loved that, And it was like, you know, I ain't claiming we were great leaders or something. We were space enablers. And then this anarchic sort of self-organized, everyone driven by wanting to be involved, would take place. And I say again that when the firemen came in, because we always let them in, when they come in, they're walking around and they're saying, mate, I'm impressed. You know what I mean? So, yeah, Tony, you know, those things are important. The only thing we didn't have was a big block of toilets, because that weren't feasible financially or practically for us at the time. But everything else, and we're, you know, of course, in those warehouses that we're cracking, there's toilets in there. So our plumber man banged the waters on, electrics on. You know what I mean? It was as good as a workplace. You just would have needed more toilets.
Well, I can imagine the news coverage of these events being all negative, you know, that way they say a terrible, dangerous thing is going on. So Mark arrives on the scene with a camera or a few cameras. How did he go about trying to capture this on film? And how did you work with him to do that?
Well, Mark, anyone who's worked with Mark knows that Mark's means of operation, his MO, is putting the camera in the hands of the people who are living the life, you know. And he was very much into that. Mark was big into that, you know. And he would also bring people with him, brilliant people with him, you know, people who are either volunteers or cameramen themselves or whatever. And he, like I say, he kind of lived with us in a way. And the cameras were there, you know. I mean, I remember one night we went out, and Mark had this big TV type camera thing, yeah, and we're in my mum's pub. And the next thing Mark said to me, did you pick my camera up? I said, no, I haven't seen it. And someone's nicked it, basically. Long story short, through our community networks, bang, 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 within half hour, we've got this geezer who's nicked it. We found out who he is, got him out, and we're going with Mark down a railway embankment, yeah. To get his camera, which had been stashed under a tree at the bottom of the embankment. And again, Mark was like, wow, man, that level of community organisation, you know, that's what Mark was so into, not just the sort of like protest contest spirit of it, which he obviously appealed to him, but the kind of self-organised, better than policing, self-policing, you know, we call it a respectocracy time. You know, whereas people hold the line and keep order because they respect the place, man. You know, it's not force that can make people do that. It's a mutual respect thing, you know.
That's Glenn Jenkins recounting episodes with Mark Saunders, sadly passed away 3 weeks ago, age 68. And I just have to say about working with Mark myself, I didn't make films with him, but was distributing some of the films that he made. And he was one of those characters you always felt that he was, and he was always there. If you needed a bit of advice, he's thinking about how to approach a topic, a subject. He was also very, very astute on, particularly on the German secret services, this sort of thing. I can remember once or twice on this show, we did something, I think it was to do with the Bilderbergers, actually, and mentioning this guy, Egon Bahr, I think it was Egon Bahr, who had defected from Germany, from West Germany to East Germany, just not long after the Second World War, probably in the 1950s, and then came back again in this weird way. That having a long chat to Mark about, oh yeah, the Germans know what happened there. This was the Verfassungsschutz, which is the German version of MI5. That there was all sorts of back channels going on actually between the Soviets, and this guy hadn't really defected at all. He was just caught doing these unofficial negotiations behind the scenes, very top level talks between the secret societies or secret people running East Germany and the same in West Germany. Maybe they were Nazis, maybe they were fascists that were doing this sort of thing. But anyway, Egon Bahr was one of the first people to get involved in inviting people and turning up at the first ever Bilderberg meeting. And Mark got that and managed to give me an angle on it that I'd not even thought anything about. So cheerio, Mark, I suppose we should say. I'll make sure those that longer interview with Glenn there is up, and a link with it to the documentaries, or at least one of the documentaries, or several that Mark made with Glenn and the Exodus Collective in Luton, Exodus Movement of Jar People being the one that I think was probably the most simple kind of gateway film to understanding what Exodus was all about. Let's just hope that his there are quite a lot of people now looking at his archive to try and make sure that many of those archives are available to filmmakers all over the world in the future. What's really been going on in London. Anyway, just to round up tonight, mention of Peter Thiel by Simon Killane earlier reminds me that we did have a conversation with Hannah over the Bilderberg meeting back in June, didn't we? And she was mentioning that Peter Thiel has got this interest and obsession with the Antichrist. What is all that about? In fact, I was looking around the other day and found that there are two interviews with him, part one and part two, with the Palantir boss, if you want, the guy that funded it, the PayPal boss, the Facebook funder, Peter Thiel, and he's suddenly getting very, very interested in the Antichrist. What on earth is going on with Peter Thiel? We can have a listen to this, but I would suggest before you hear it, he's aware that the Antichrist is a very powerful idea, particularly in the Middle East, the idea that if there is utter chaos in the Middle East, as Netanyahu is instigating, that an Antichrist will appear on the scene at some point to stop the war, to supposedly sort all the chaos out. And everyone will be saying, thank God for this person, because this is very much like what happened with Adolf Hitler in Nazi Germany. When he arrived on the scene, a lot of people were very pleased to see Hitler. He's starting to organise the country. In fact, otherwise very sensible types like the psychologist, Rudolf Steiner, etc., people like that welcomed Hitler. And then slowly Hitler unfolded his plan, which is quite clearly the same sort of modus operandi. Dennis Wheatley, in fact, it was, I think, who talked about Adolf Hitler as a kind of prototype for the Antichrist. But anyway, why is Peter Thiel going on about the Antichrist? Well, it's because he knows that he's one of the people who's trying to instigate this whole thing, and so he's trying to get ahead of the game so everyone thinks he's the nice guy, when maybe he's one of the instigators.
For the first time in history, we can actually imagine human beings destroying the world. That's quite a plot. Now, also, we have the mechanisms that would make world government, a gigantic global surveillance state, is plausible.
That seems plausible, too. And then I think, again, to come back to the Solovyov-Benson plot hole, on its own, they both seem not that desirable. Why would we have a crazy surveillance state? Why would we do this? But if you're scared enough of these things, that's the weapon. And this is sort of where, my speculative thesis is that if the Antichrist were to come to power, it would be by talking about Armageddon all the time. And
Peter Thiel, the Antichrist would talk about Armageddon all the time. He'd scare people and then offer to save them.
Yes, it's the 1 Thessalonians 5:3. The slogan of the Antichrist is peace and safety. And so, which is nothing wrong with peace and safety, but you have to sort of imagine that it resonates very differently in a world where the stakes are so absolute, where the stakes are so extreme, where the alternative to peace and safety is, Armageddon and the destruction of all things. And then that's where peace and safety gets you way more than it would have in 1750.
René Girard, in I Saw Satan Fall Like Lightning, one of his books, the Antichrist boasts of bringing to human beings the peace and tolerance that Christianity promised but has failed to deliver.
There are probably, I think there are all these elements where it's downstream from Christianity. You can think of, the poor shall inherit the earth, Sermon on the Mount. Marxist theory is we're going to be more Christian, we're going to accelerate it, we're going to bring it about faster. So there is, the Antichrist probably presents as a great humanitarian, as a great, it's redistributive, as an extremely great philanthropist, as an effective altruist, all of those right. Those kinds of things, and these things are not, simply anti-Christian, but It is always when they get overly combined with state power that something is very wrong. You know, there are sort of ways Christ wants to unify the world. You have the parable of the Good Samaritan where, you know, you should take care of people even if you're not related to them. And that's, it's good to act like the Good Samaritan and to take care of people not just in your family or tribe or country. But then if you force everyone to be a Good Samaritan and you force a borderless world, it's somehow adjacent. Somehow it's an intensification, but it's somehow also very much the opposite.
Okay, Scylla and Charybdis, and we come here. It'll take me another moment to set this up, but we come here. We depart now from Peter Thiel's analysis, and we come to Peter Thiel's exhortation. What needs to be done? Step or two to complete the analysis, and then it leads to what needs to be done, the questions at least we need to be asking. Scylla and Charybdis. Odysseus is on his way home, and he has to sail past two sea monsters. Scylla is a six-headed monster who will devour sailors, and Charybdis is a whirlpool that swallows ships whole and then spits them back out. And of course, they stand for sort of the horns of a dilemma. That's the way Scylla and Charybdis get used. The phrase. Peter Thiel, everyone is worried about the Scylla of Armageddon. Nukes, pandemics, AI. Everyone is worried about the Scylla of Armageddon. We're not worried enough about the Charybdis of one world government, the Antichrist. Explain.
This just seems obviously correct. it's like if you think about the language that we've been using in this program, it's Armageddon is not that taboo. You can just talk about that by referencing the newspapers.
Right.
You know, we are sleepwalking into Armageddon, maybe not in the Ukraine or the Middle East, but maybe with Taiwan and China. So there are all these.
Everybody feels the dread.
We can use Armageddon, and maybe it's literal and maybe it's metaphorical, but that's totally acceptable. So that tells you that's not the thing that's taboo. Antichrist is like, wow, what planet are you from?
Right.
And so that tells me that the existential risks are very selective of the sort that we've given, and the fears about a one world state are downplayed because they are the solution to the other ones. That is the self-governing, politically atheist, humans governing themselves solution to Armageddon is, you know, it's what Bostrom says. It's a, you know, it's effective world government with extremely effective policing to stop, you know, dangerous technologies from being developed and to force people to, you know, not have too diverse a set of views, because the diversity of views is what's going to push some scientists to develop technologies they shouldn't be developing. And so we are just so grooved to the Antichrist solution. We don't worry about it because it presents itself as the solution to all these others. And then my intuition is that what that tells me is that, we should worry about both, but if you had to prioritize them, you should be way more worried about the Antichrist because no one's worried about it. And of course, you know, I don't know how literally one should take these biblical accounts, but in the biblical accounts, the Antichrist comes first because people are more scared of Armageddon than the Antichrist, perhaps. So the Antichrist comes first. It doesn't quite work. The one world state doesn't work. It still goes haywire. You know, maybe you have a fantastic communist government, but somehow the AI still goes mad and you still get to Armageddon. But that's what comes first.
Right.
Peter Thiel there discussing the Antichrist. I find it amazing that he's sort of in the position of saying, well, you know, this kind of thing might happen. But you're making it happen. What you're doing with your mates is creating the chaos, the very chaos that's necessary for example, the use of artificial intelligence to replace decisions being made by human beings. This is you, mate. This is what you're doing. The idea of funding someone like Alex Karp, who can press a button and kill thousands of people using
automatic swarms of drones. This is you, Peter Thiel, that's doing all this. And I suppose it's because he's afraid, he's worried, and he's actually basically accusing others of doing what he's doing. He's very much like the Israelis. They're always accusing people of doing what they do. And this has been going on particularly with the genocidalists for a very, very long time. So thank you very much, Hannah, for pointing that out. And also, I think it was the guy from Labour Heartlands as well that has written something about this. Very, very interesting that Peter Thiel is kind of showing out. And so well worth a listen. I'll put the full version of that two-part interview with both parts up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. Very interested to hear what you, dear listeners, make of what Peter Thiel's up to. But it seems pretty obvious to me is he knows what he's up to, and he's trying to make out... In fact, very, very similar to the programme which we haven't had time for this week, which went out earlier this week on Radio 4 about the Dark Enlightenment with Mike Wendling. So what they do, the Radio 4s and the Peter Thiels and the Nick Lands and the Mike Wendlings, is they present you with the person that's causing Armageddon as someone to explain it all to us. So... Of course, they're not going to explain it to us. What they'll do is they'll just send us off down various little rabbit holes and in completely the wrong direction. And actually, maybe if these people the BBC are cozying up to were to be properly grilled, then these horrific things which are coming down the pipeline wouldn't happen, eh? So it's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off. Thanks very much to our guests this week, who were Matt O'Brannan, again, also Roland Dye and Sue Luger from Bristol Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. Also, both of them connected, obviously, as you could hear earlier on, with the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Gaza, etc. Thanks very much to Glenn Jenkins, who spoke to me about poor old Mark Saunders, no longer with us, but a brilliant filmmaker with an amazing legacy and archive. And also, as the great explainer, Simon Killane, the former Lib Dem councillor over in Malmesbury and on Wiltshire County Council, doing an excellent job there. Also to sound engineer, wrestling with our problems with contacts with the live stream this week. And so I've been streaming this live on my phone, part of it anyway, through the iRig plugged into the phone. But obviously we'll have a real good old look at this and make sure that we're connected up properly for next week. So that's thanks to sound engineer Dave Bazanko, who's been wrestling with this on and off throughout the programme. The problem connecting to the stream at talkradio.org.uk. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow, if you didn't get it live, follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do send me interviews and story tips on the Telegram channel and elsewhere. The BCFM Politics Show page includes the podcast, the full-length interviews, story links and comment page. Great long one from Simon Killane, ranting away, but from a very informed point of view about the death of democracy and how to fix it in Britain. You can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter, and if you can afford it, you can also donate or even set up a small monthly sub at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. You'll get my paperbacks, the links at bilderberg.org. You can either download something, download a free one, or even buy an actual physical book there. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the stream. We hope, if we can get back in touch with it again. Do please make live recordings. We've been streaming live from Bristol on YouTube this week and a bit on TikTok, not the usual place, not from Nunneaton, I would imagine, but they will be using the programme later. So have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend while we try and figure out what went wrong with internetradio.com. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5 o'clock. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters... get you down.
Is that something that the British government is looking at? The idea of a vaccine passport specifically to allow people to come and go in the months ahead?
No, we're not. Vaccines are not mandated in this country, as Boris Johnson's quite rightly reminded Parliament. You know, that's not how we do things in the UK. We do them by consent. We yet don't know what the impact of vaccines on transmission is, and it would be discriminatory.
Hey, yo, they lie and they cheat. They were born to deceive. In the land of the lost, they mislead the naive. Gotta turn the telly off, cause it keeps you asleep. The reason for this pandemic is a digital idea. Yo, they lie and they cheat. We follow like we're sheep in a Freemasonic system. They don't want us free. The age of Aquarius, the rise of machines. We have to rebel and fight the digital ID. Ayo, how many times have they fed us lies and gone back on their word and then tried to deny? How many times have they committed crimes against humanity for the greater good, but yo, we got disguised? How many times are we gonna ignore the signs? Without the passport, you can't buy food because you get declined. How many times will you get pushed until you grow a spine? We live in a society where blind will lead the blind. We've entered a new age. They're priming us like souffle. They're trying to introduce a credit system like it's doomsday. I don't care if you think I'm crazy. I might sound it to you. They got the old order, now upgrading it to new. There's no conspiracy, it's here to see. I don't know how you can't agree. Digital ID is what the Bible calls mark of the beast. And I ain't down with that. That's why I take into the streets. There's so much negative. I'm trying to balance it with peace. Hey, they lie and they cheat. They were born to deceive. In the land of the lost, they mislead the naive. Gotta turn the telly off, cause it keeps you asleep. The reason for this pandemic is a digital idea. Yo, they lie and they cheat. We follow like we're sheep in a Freemasonic system. They don't want us free. The age of Aquarius, the rise of machines. We have to rebel and fight the digital ID. We've all seen the films, they're programming the people, conditioning them to accept the next part of the sequel. All they want is a predictable society. They want obedience and want you to comply with the elite. But I ain't having it. I've always been the blackest sheep. I'm banging on this system, seeing cracks in the concrete. I'll never give up. Yo, I'll never retreat. That's why you catch me with my megaphone up in the street. Shops soon cashless. They want it digitalized. They want to merge it with your passport that's being designed. You can dismiss it as conspiracy, but show me the lie. Technocracy is coming. You gotta open your eyes. These lot of cycles, they need us. We don't need them. Even the Terminator told you himself.
Screw your freedom.
We think we're free, but we live in tyranny. I'd rather stand for something than to live on my knees. Hey, yo, they lie and they cheat. They were born to deceive. In the land of the lost, they mislead the naive. Gotta turn the telly off, cause it keeps you asleep. The reason for this pandemic is a digital idea. Yo, they lie and they cheat. We follow like we're sheep in a Freemasonic system. They don't want us free. The age of Aquarius, the rise of machines. We have to rebel and fight the digital ID.
Okay, so there won't be a vaccine passport?
No, that's not being planned.
At all, ever.
Well,
not happening.
I certainly am not planning to introduce any vaccine passports.
Eventually, there will be sort of this digital immunity proof that, you know, will help facilitate the global reopening up.
Bombs drop down, cities burn, the smoke goes up and out. Into the stratosphere, ash spreads and envelops Earth. Blocking sunlight to surface pools, goes dark and dry.
Pictures the steam, she pictures the soul See you.